We are recording. Ladies and gentlemen, we are recording and broadcast.
Recording in progress.
The floor is yours.
Good morning. Welcome to the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control meeting on June the 9th. We are taking an agenda item for closed session out of order, and we will convene into closed session at 8 o'clock. We're going to open this meeting, and our goal is to come back to our regular agenda at 9 a.m., which is our tradition. We'll be in closed session. We might run a little bit late, so stay tuned, but our goal is to return at 9. So I'll call the meeting to order, and please call the roll.
Dr. Barbonell?
Here.
Mr. Anderson?
Here.
Ms. Blair is already in Teams. Dr. Olson?
Here.
Mr. Strawn, I believe, is in Teams as well. Ms. Warren? And Chair Cantu?
Here. So we have a quorum. At this point, we'll recess to closed session, unless we technically are not recessing. We will convene in closed session, and you can expect us back here for the rest of our regular agenda at 9 a.m. or shortly thereafter. Thank you very much.
Chair Cantu, if I may just announce the item that the board is meeting in closed session to discuss.
Of course. Thank you.
The board will be meeting this morning in closed session to discuss item 12I, that's People of the State of California versus International Boundary and Water Commission. Board members and staff attending the closed session should log off of the Zoom meeting and join the Teams meeting. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are recording.
Madam Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning. We have reconvened into our public session, and we'll continue with our agenda. I'll ask our attorney to announce the actions of our closed session at this point. Thank you, Vincent Wu.
Thank you, Chair. The board met in closed session this morning and provided direction to counsel.
Thank you. So we're now in open session. Do we need to call the roll again, or we've already, that's established, our quorum is established?
Yeah, the quorum has been established.
Okay, so we have, we're excited to say that we have a little extra announcement as we get started here. Dave Gibson joins me in this accomplishment award, the Sustained Accomplishment Award. I'm really pleased to present to the Superior Accomplishment Award to Vinti Sieve and Florentino, known to us as Tino Gamboa, of the Division of Information Technology, for their monumental efforts in keeping our board, our staff, and our office fully operational through the many challenges brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. Before the pandemic, Tino and Vinti were already managing a heavy workload of staff support services, including managing the Water Board's web pages and addressing the need to make thousands of pages of our web published documents ADA compliant. But when the pandemic hit California, the Water Board staff were directed to work from home, and Tino and Vinti deployed all of our available laptops and other equipment to staff, helped train us to use Teams and Zoom, and help to incorporate other new software and tools to support our staff from working from their homes. They provided immediate one-on-one assistance to everyone, including us board members, having trouble with their systems, and went far beyond the typical daily work requirements. No matter how challenging or stressful the circumstances, they responded with their customary can-do positive attitude and professionalism. While other agencies and organizations suffered significant delays due to this workforce shift, the San Diego Water Board did not need to put any staff on administrative leave due to their inability to work from home, and we met most of our performance targets. Because of their innovative and adaptive solutions, the Water Board now has an expanded arsenal of tools to help us maintain our effectiveness in protecting the waters of the state, even while working remotely. Thank you, Tino and Vinti, for your unequaled personal effort in helping us overcome these unusual circumstances and helping us fulfill our mission without delays or major cost to the state. So I hope they are online to hear this. I see Tino. So I'm very pleased. Congratulations. Let's all do an applause. Yes, very good. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you. And keep it up, because we still need help. So congratulations. At this point, we will open the public forum, and any member of the public may address or ask questions of the board relating to any matter within the San Diego Regional Water Board's jurisdiction, provided that matter is not on the agenda or pending before our board. Roger, will you introduce any speakers we may have? There will be 3 minutes.
Yes, and before I introduce any speakers, I will go ahead and provide the opening statement for our remote meeting.
Thank you, Roger.
Good morning. My name is Roger Mitchell, and I am the Supervising Engineering Geologist for the San Diego Water Board. Today, I am serving as the remote meeting coordinator and would like to share some instructions on how to participate in today's virtual board meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment during the public forum or during one of the board agenda items, you must be signed into Zoom webinar or be participating by phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org, and you want to comment on an agenda item, you will need to register to sign into the Zoom webinar or call into the meeting. Information on how to participate can be found on the San Diego Water Board meeting agenda website. Public comments will be accepted on each item after all presentations for the item are complete. If you wish to speak on an item, please virtually raise your hand. If you are using a computer or tablet, please use the raise hand button in Zoom. If you are calling into Zoom, please dial *9 to raise your hand. Please use the raise hand function feature to let the board know you wish to speak, even if you previously registered and indicated that you wish to speak on an item. If you do not raise your hand, we will assume you no longer wish to speak. When public comments start on an item, the commenter order will be determined by the order each person raised their hand. I will call on each commenter by name, or if you are on the phone, I will call the last 3 digits of your phone number, and then I will unmute each person when it is their turn to speak. Please note, you will not appear by video during your testimony. There is a 3-minute time limit for each public commenter. However, that time could be extended at the chair's discretion. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen for those calling in by phone. We will run the timer and let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. I would like to remind everyone participating in the board meeting today to state your name for the record before you speak, and please mute your microphone if you are not speaking. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text to area code 805-801-3676 or email it@agpvideo.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. I always appreciate you reminding me about that. Do we have anybody signed up for a public forum?
We do, and I do see three hands raised. First I see is Mike Beeman.
Good morning, Mike Beeden, South Laguna. Is this coming through?
Yes.
Thank you. I want to thank the staff and board for allowing online testimony. Please pull up the slideshow. Next slide, please. Okay, I can't tell if this is working.
I'm not seeing any slides.
I'm pulling it up now.
Okay, takes a moment. There we go. Thank you.
Thank you. Next slide, please. So I'm requesting that, sorry, I'm going so slow, I'll figure it out. I'm requesting the board to study the NOAA and U.S. Navy coastal charts to better understand the Gulf of Santa Catalina, and with that, to calculate the impacts of secondary sewage discharges to Gulf waters feeding harmful algae blooms. And after that, pursue regulations to advance emerging tools, technologies, for zero liquid discharge to the regional board's coastal receiving waters. Next slide, please. Are we a gulf or an ocean? Next slide. In 1542, Juan Cabrillo sailed into the Gulf of Santa Catalina. Next slide. The Southern California eddy current retains ocean discharges within the Gulf. Next slide. Gulf waters concentrate ocean discharges and constituents to elevate sea surface temperatures. Next slide. USC scientists say the Southern California coast is a toxic algae hotspot and the problem is not going away anytime soon. Under the right conditions, certain algae releases domoic acid, which is a neurotoxin, and the toxin can attack the nervous system of animals and can cause amnesic shellfish poisoning in people. Next slide. Sea lions are the sentinels of ocean health in the Gulf of Santa Catalina, and there are three areas for future research, including the effects of contaminants and hormones on the development of cancer, the progression of how cancer spreads to identify potential markers, and how contaminant exposure is impacting the immune function and overall health of sea lions exposed to high levels of harmful algae blooms, DDT, and PBCs. Next slide, please. The recommended action is to study the charts, established charts, and as I said, calculate the impacts and regulate for zero liquid discharge. Next slide, please. Knowledge is power, and I want to thank you for your dedication to the ocean and Gulf. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Beeman. Do we have anyone else?
Yes, we have two more speakers.
May I make a comment to Mr. Beeman?
Go right ahead.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I think the people who would do this study would be the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project in Costa Mesa, known as SCWRP. And our executive director, Dave Gibson, is a commissioner for that agency, and perhaps he can help you direct your comments to them. They are the Applied Science Lab for Coastal Southern California.
Thank you for that. And as a lifelong surfer, scuba diver, and native Californian, I was actually surprised by discovering what we knew in 1542, that these are Gulf waters and they're not the Pacific Ocean. And this can shift our awareness of our discharges. So I'm familiar with SCWRP and I appreciate the recommendation and hope we can all work together to better refine the science behind our regulations.
Thank you. And this is consistent also with our recycling goals for the state. So very happy to hear this.
Next,
Roger,
have...
will you please call on our next public speaker?
Yes, Armina Arino.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, my name is Armita Arellano. On behalf of Orange County Coastkeeper, please accept the following comment regarding the settlement agreement on the Laguna Beach sanitary sewage overflow that occurred in 2019. We support the proposed intertie project and its-
Excuse me, I believe this is an agendized item which we will hear, and we invite you to add your comments when this agenda item has is called on.
Oh, okay.
Great, thank you. We'll just stay cool till we'll get to it very soon. Thank you.
John Elliers.
Hello, am I coming through okay?
You are.
Okay, hello, my name is John Elliers. I'm a resident of Laguna Beach, and I want to relate to the board two items of information that may pertain to the water board's deliberation.
Excuse me, again, this is an agendized item. You are very welcomed and invited to share your comments during that item on today's agenda.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Just to reiterate, the public forum, we invite people who wish to share information that are not on our agenda and not anticipated to be agendized, you know, in the relatively short future. But anything that's on the agenda, we will call on you. Make yourself known at the time that we take that up later today. We definitely want to hear from you at the right time. Roger, does that include our public forum?
I believe it does. I do have a question for Mr. Beenan. I see that your hand is raised again. Are you wishing to address the board a second time?
Mr. Beenan, you're on mute if you want to respond now. If not, we will move on and with our agenda. Okay, great. I think we've resolved the hand raising function is always a challenge for us all.
We have, and there are no other comments at this time.
Thank you, Roger. So let's continue with our board business. The first item of business is the review and adoption of our minutes. I will call for a motion and a second for the minutes as published.
This is Betty Olson. I'll move approval.
Thank you, Dr. Olson.
I'll second it.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Chris needs to call the roll, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. And I've just been reading the Sturgis parliamentary procedure book I received yesterday.
Dr. Barbanel.
Yes.
Mr. Anderson. Ms. Blair is not here. Dr. Olson.
Aye.
Mrs. Strawn.
Aye.
Ms. Warren.
Approved to the extent I participated in the meeting.
And Chair Cantu.
Aye. Okay, motion carries. At this point, we'll invite board members and our state board liaison, Laura Firestone, and our executive officer to offer their reports. We'll start with our state board member, Laura Firestone. Welcome.
Great. Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I wanted to give an overall update, and then I also brought some slides to go over the drinking water risk assessment information that's more specific and zoomed into this region. So I'll do that after the more of a board liaison report on what's been going on most immediately at the State Water Board. So we are really focused right now on drought preparedness and response. I think I've gone over this at the last update, the last meeting, but we are in we do have an emergency proclamation around drought for most of California, central and northern California, really bad in the upper Russian River watershed. And we issued on May 26 a notification of water unavailability to 930 junior water rights holders in the upper Russian River Basin, that there's not enough water in the system and diversions must be immediately reduced to safeguard the community's drinking water availability later this year and next year. And so that means that those who continue diverting can be subject to enforcement actions, including fines of $1,000 per day. And we're expecting those notices to remain in effect until winter rains restore flows. That, as a reminder, that's really precipitation dependent water system or in that watershed doesn't have imported water supplies. We are also working on a curtailment emergency regulation package for adoption very soon in mid-June and implementation sometime in July. Overall, we have a drought webpage, kind of a landing page that they went over at our last board meeting that provides information on current drought conditions, email subscription list and staff contacts. And if you have feedback or questions, you can send it to drought@waterboards.ca.gov. We also got information from Division of Drinking Water at the last board meeting on drought conditions potentially affecting drinking water supplies and what we're doing in response, and focused on the Upper Russian River watershed where we have the most acute challenges. So specifically Fort Bragg, Marin Municipal Water District, and also Folsom Lake, which isn't in the Upper Russian Water Shed, but is at critically low levels. So we were continuing to track and respond to emergencies around drinking water supplies up in that northern part of California. We also got a temporary urgency change petition from the Bureau of Reclamation and Department of Water Resources on May 18th, and we have had a public comment period. It's basically the petition seeks or sought modification for outflow requirements and relocation of compliance station and certain limits and limits certain exports from the State Water Project and Central Valley Project. And we approved that on June 1st. And we're asking that they submit early their what we expect to be another TCP temporary urgency change proposal for September through December by the end of June, so that we can have a more robust public process around that. And lastly, on drought, the executive order doesn't mandate any domestic use water restrictions. It's not a statewide emergency declaration, but we do really can recommend and encourage Californians to take every opportunity to save water where they can. Some municipalities have already adopted mandatory local water savings requirements in those really critical areas, and many have called for voluntary water use reductions. And if you want to learn more about tips on how to conserve water, both in terms of outdoor landscape irrigation and indoor water use, you can go to saveourwater.com. On water quality, the integrated report, which you all know, includes the 303D list of impaired waters and 305B assessment of surface waters for water bodies in a number of regions for the 2020-2022 time period. So we released a draft of that and includes the San Diego region. For this 2020 through 2022 integrated report and going forward, the State Water Board is administering the public process for all regional boards. And the draft report will include 1,200 new listings of impaired water bodies and approximately 200 new delistings. We just released that for public comment on the 4th, and we'll be holding a public hearing July 6th, and we're scheduled to consider adoption of the report by January 2022. And that change in the public process going through the state board is really to deal with the timing challenges and settlements with legal challenges on the adoption of these integrated reports on the timeline that we need to meet. I've brought this up, I feel like every time recently that I've had board liaison reports, but the construction stormwater general permit, we, as you know, it regulates stormwater discharges associated with construction activities disturbing 1 or more acres. And we adopted the existing permit in 2009, which expired in 2014 and has been administratively extended until the effective date of a reissued permit. So we did release on May 28th the proposed statewide NPDES construction stormwater general permit for a 60-day public comment period. We're holding two public workshops on June 9th and 10th. And we'll hold public hearings to hear oral comments on July 7th. And again, those public comments period ends July 30th. And then lastly, we'll be going this summer, the Water Board will present the racial equity resolution that we have been working on across the water boards for with the state board staff and regional board staff. And we will be presenting that for public comment this summer with the hope that the state board can adopt what we're going to adopt for the final racial equity resolution, and hopefully regional boards as well will be adopting some form of building off what's coming out of the Joint Water Boards work group around that. So stay tuned for that later this summer. I think actually pretty soon we'll be able to see a draft. And that's my overall liaison report on what we've been focused on. And so if there's any questions on that, I'm happy to answer them. And then after that, I would love to just go over a few slides on the needs assessment.
Thank you. Any questions from the board for State Board Member Firestone? Henry, I see your hand up.
It is. I have a report from the City of Del Mar's representative to the County San Diego County Water Authority, which says that we are in very good shape being drought resistant because the San Diego County Water Authority, which as you know, is the supplier for almost all of our water, has invested in many sources of water and we don't have a problem. And I wonder if Laurel can comment on the San Diego County Water Authority success and how it might be useful for the state board to communicate that to other California counties.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, overall across the state, we've really seen urban water agencies and the investments that they've made to diversify sources and conserve water and build more resiliency, proving their value as we've been entering this drought. Because there's just much less risk than there was from previous droughts. And I think you can see that with the San Diego County Water Authority's work in particular, in terms of diversifying supplies, water recycling, and, is a great model and example of how that's happening.
Dr. Olson.
Sorry, just one other thing. We are in critical drought through much of the Colorado River Basin. So I think all of those water systems, as we look forward into the future, even though we are not as critical as some states because of our priority within that, there's just huge challenges overall in that watershed on water supply. So I think, just to say, thank goodness, and because of that hard work, we are not in as critical a place as we could be, but still we wanna be ensuring that we're making conservation a way of life and building resiliency. And so it's not a, so that work should continue.
I think that's a good point. This region has a diversified water supply, but two of the largest sources of water, the Colorado and the State Water Project, are both in severe drought. Colorado being in the 14th year of a severe drought. And we're well aware of Northern California, where we get a good deal, about a third of our water. So it's we have storage, which is good, but we don't have storage forever and ever and ever. And people are now characterizing this drought that it could likely be a mega drought, which will go on much longer than our storage will be able to provide. So conservation as a way of life has got to be what Californians have always done and will always probably need to do. Dr. Olson.
Yes, I just wanted to bring to Laurel's attention some of the concerns that I've heard in Orange County. And it has to do with the legislation that's pending on indoor water use. So as you know, many communities in Southern California are newer communities and they meet all the requirements. What was noted in the last drought was that those communities, as opposed to older communities, were only able to reduce their water use about 2%. So my question is, I know that letters are being sent to the state board and the legislators, so I'm not going to speak to that. But what I'm wondering is, how is the state going to address indoor water use hardening? I think we haven't seen that outdoors, but I think in newer communities it's occurring, and I'd just like to hear your viewpoint on that, please.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things happening on water conservation. One is there are bills pending in the legislature that would set expectations for indoor water use efficiency. And that is based on a per capita amount. And mm-hmm. so it's not what happened in the last drought where there was the initial proclamation was everyone needs to reduce by a certain percentage. The way that both the legislation and I don't know and can't comment on the specific legislation, but what I do know more of is also the recommendations that we're going through for as mandated by a previous legislation that was signed to set indoor and outdoor water efficiency standards. Basically the Department of Water Resources and the State Board have been working with a lot of stakeholders over years. We're still in that process. There's a joint report that went out recently with a lot of recommendations on what indoor and outdoor standards, efficiency standards should be. Ultimately, that all gets rolled up with water loss standards into a regulatory package that we would adopt around making conservation a way of life and water conservation efficiency standards. Again, all of that is really going to be based on, especially for the indoor, it's going to be based on per capita. So as you said, newer and more urbanized areas that have been doing an incredible amount of conservation and efficiency already may not have to reduce at all for at least the indoor use, depending on what they're already doing. It's not relative to what you're doing in terms of efficiency. It's really relative to the amount per capita. And that is very much in process in terms of studies and recommendations. And we're still a bit away from actually starting a full regulatory process around that, but definitely there's a lot of work going on and this is a really good time to get involved in that. And you know, as I said, I can't comment so much on the legislative front, but I do know that that's also being considered.
Well, what I've been apprised of and have not looked at myself to comment on the accuracy of them, but there's issues with how studies are being done or have been done and the calculations used. And I'm sure you're well aware of them.
Yes.
And have heard them and you will hear more of it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, and that's the value of the public process, I think, is to get all of that input and help making sure that, you know, we have the best available data and input on how to do it right. So I think really appreciate all of that involvement.
Okay, great. Just letting you know. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any more questions from our board members concerning drought specific? Okay. I just have a comment. I'm really surprised that there hasn't been action on the Klamath. We've all read about the dire situation there, which is not new. So I was wondering if you had any ability to comment on that.
The Klamath, the Scott Valley, a number of things on Shasta. So there are a number of really critical areas and watersheds in Northern California, Klamath in particular, but that are in critical conditions, and there is a lot of work going on there. Each of those have unique circumstances. So in the Klamath, most of the water supply is actually and controls over that is through the Bureau and just over the border into Oregon. And so there's less of a role that we have in terms of issuing curtailments, for example, and the kinds of things that we've been doing on the Russian River watershed. At least that's my understanding. We have less control over that than even Scott Valley and areas along Shasta. We definitely are paying attention and trying, you know, working, our water rights staff are really involved in all of those areas, trying to make sure that we're issuing notices of unavailability, looking at emergency regulations as needed. And like we said, I think we are, we were given the authority and direction to consider and adopt where necessary emergency regulations for things like curtailment. And so we're really actively evaluating that in a lot of, more than just the Russian River watershed. That's the one we're a little bit ahead on in terms of timing, because it was the first one to be declared.
I guess that's my point, is there has not been a declaration of emergency in the Klamath area that I've seen.
Oh, no, it has.
It has? Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Because that gives relief to the farmers. Okay. I missed that. Thank you. I'm so happy to hear it.
Yep. Yeah, it was, it kind of got lost a little bit, I think, because it was also around the time of a lot of the budget announcements, but the emergency proclamations were extended, frankly, to, I think it's maybe 40% of California. So a huge area, including Klamath, really
all good.
Northern California and down into the San Joaquin Valley.
Thank you. Any comments for board member Firestone on the integrated listing? I mean, those numbers really stand out. Listing 1200 new, delisting 600. We're losing ground that's never been reversed. That happens every single time. It just shows that we need more resources to do a better job, that a better job is being called of us, and we can't do that without additional resources. I think that should be really made known to our legislators. If there's no more questions, let's move into your presentation, your slide presentation.
Great. And I don't know, can you all, bring that up? That'd be great. Great. Okay, so I mentioned before we released this first ever, and I think really first in the nation, in-depth analyses that we have done statewide around drinking water needs assessment, looking both at those community water systems and schools that are unable and failing to provide an adequate supply of safe drinking water, and domestic well, or those systems also that are at risk of failing, as well as domestic well and state small communities and wells where there's really high risk of what this one focused on was water quality challenges. We also looked at affordability. We looked at reliability and water supply risk and technical, managerial, financial capacity risk as part of the risk assessment. So what I wanted to do was just as I talked about this was have these slides that could help us drill in on this area in particular. And mostly there's a lot of really fantastic tools online where you can have interactive, the ability to interact and kind of dig into what's going on in your region in all of these areas. And so wanted to make sure people knew how to get that as well. So if you go to the next slide, so originally even before this bigger program that we have developed called SAFER, we developed this, what we call the Human Right to Water List, which are just those systems, their community systems or schools that are failing to meet drinking water standards. So that is what this map drills in here. It's updated quarterly on the Water Board website. On average, 90% of the violations occur in water systems serving less than 500 connections. So this really is a small community water system and schools, school self-supplied challenge overall in the state. Let's see, San Diego County had 16 water systems that were on this list. The vast majority of those were mobile home parks that had their own water system. There was a few elementary schools, Clover Flat Elementary School, Campo Elementary School, but there's about 16 systems overall that are already on this failing water system list. And I know that, I don't know the specifics in this area of how many, but overall statewide, I believe 95% of those systems are receiving some kind of, are pursuing long-term solutions with our Division of Financial Assistance. So we know that there is active work going on to address those issues. Go to the next slide. There's also the big addition that was done over the last year is being able to look at which systems are really at risk of failing. And so there were 19 risk indicators around water quality, water accessibility / supply. So that includes, for example, does a water system have a single source where there is no backup? And are they in a critically overdrafted basin? You know, adding those things together, you get a really high risk score on accessibility. We also had indicators on affordability and technical, managerial, financial capacity. And then we developed a total risk score, and you can access the list, both the list for each county and statewide, of at-risk systems and those human right to water systems by failing systems by county. For San Diego County, there were 13 at-risk systems and 12 potentially at-risk systems. So you can see that on the map. There's, again, many of those are small. Well, they're pretty much all small, but it includes some schools, some middle and elementary schools, but also a lot of mobile home parks, some small mutual water companies, and you can get that list, or if you have questions, I have that handy if you want. If you go down to the next slide, there's also really great interactive maps on at-risk areas for domestic wells and state small water systems. So those that are state small is those that are even less than a community system. So it's less than 15 connections, more than 5 connections of homes or other other users that use the water system essentially full time as their drinking water source. Those state smalls are regulated through counties. But the domestic wells and state smalls really are the most at risk and have relatively limited water quality information. There's not the same level of testing requirements. And so this map helps to both map where those are for the first time in much more complete ways, and then integrate the water quality information on different contaminants of concern in terms of groundwater for water quality. So you can, this is a kind of combined risk map, but you can, when you click on these, you can actually do it by individual chemicals. So you could look, you know, you can click just for nitrate, where are there hotspots and areas of concern there, just for uranium. The really, I would say, you know, just clicking around in this, nitrate and 1-2-3 TCP had pretty significant hotspot areas. Very different from those were also arsenic and uranium. So all of those seem to have some high areas in this region, but very different locations for things like where there's naturally occurring arsenic or uranium versus nitrate and 1-2-3 TCP, both of which are often associated with agriculture or past agricultural activity. Going on to the next slide. There's, so this just, I want to make sure people know where to find these things because they're buried in our not very user-friendly website. So this is the Human Right to Water list. And it's just mostly a PDF. So it's, but you can filter the spreadsheet by county. If you go to the next slide, there's this I find a much more useful tool. So this is this new interactive system where you can actually go click on each individual system and see not only what their violations are and what their contaminants are, but also where they are in terms of solutions. So are they receiving a grant from us for construction, for example? So that's, and the type of solution. There's just a lot more detailed information. So really recommend this one. And this is the, you know, if you zoom in, you can see where those failing systems are in San Diego County in particular. If you go to the next slide. Let's see. I want to make sure I'm looking at the right one. So for the at-risk water systems, there's you can sort by county. It's really through this data spreadsheet that we have. And I'll say if your water system is there and you have concerns about why it's there, there are ways to dig into that and request changes if you're the water system and think it's based on information that isn't correct. And that's gonna be, that's updated regularly. And going on to the next one, let's see, next, there we go. The aquifer at risk map, again, that's one where you can drill on individual contaminants. You can see where there's domestic well locations and try to looking at risk for those really at risk. users. You can also click on where there's water system boundaries. This link here is really where you can get all, the prior links are each tool specific, but if you go to the Water Board's website, www.waterboards.ca.gov, and then you go to /safer, that's our safer website. If you click on data or go into, or you know, have /safer_data, that's where you can get all of these tools in one. So you can see all of them. I really recommend that if you're interested in digging into any of this. And also, if you, going on to the next slide, if you are interested in digging into the full needs assessment report on, again, on failing water systems, the methodologies, at-risk systems, how we're analyzing that, affordability, all of that is, and actually there's one specific to tribal systems. Those are all, you know, you can dig into all of that on this website for the full report, and you can also access through the SAFER website. So that is all I wanted to start with. My understanding is there's potentially future agendas looking at or plans to bring in drinking water more with this board to provide updates around a number of, or discussion around a number of different integrations between the Regional Water Board and our Division of Drinking Water in the future. But so if this is something that you wanna dig into more through that, I think we could accommodate that. But also just happy to answer any questions now on all of this, all of these tools and information that I just went through.
Well, thank you. This is a wealth of information. We have more understanding of the health of our drinking water sources today than we have ever had before. Any questions on this issue for our State Board Member Firestone?
Laurel, can I go back to something you said a little bit earlier before the SAFER presentation?
Yeah,
thanks. What was the what is the name of the website you gave for water conservation tips?
Oh, Save Our Water. Let's see, make sure I'm getting it right. It is, yeah, saveourwater.com. So saveourwater.com.
Thanks. And Dave, I know we don't have a tremendous social media following, but is that something that we could push out on our social channels?
Yes, Stephanie, we can certainly put that out on our social media and we'd be glad to do so. There is also now a new drought webpage that has additional resources that we can also advertise through our social media.
Great. Thank you.
Great idea. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much. You've given us so much information. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for letting me go so long and appreciate all the work you all do. And we'll see you soon. I'll follow this meeting and then see you at the next one.
Thank you. Now we'll invite board members for announcements or reports that they would like to share at this point. Just raise your hand or wave wildly in your video screen. If there are none, I have a very brief report. We had two meetings that were of note since our last meeting in May. One was the chairs retreat, where all the chairs spend most of a day together, well, not together, but virtually, to get an update of where we are as a state. It was very well attended, 100% attendance. We heard from secretaries of Cal EPA and Resources and Agriculture. We heard from the legislative liaison for the horseshoe for the governor's legislative person who is focusing on water. and various other reports. Much of the discussion was around drought. Some of the discussion was around the budget process and our needs for resources. Finally, it was about our racial equity effort. So I thought it was very informative and appreciated them going to the trouble to organize that. We also met, our staff and Dave and I met with Assemblymember Christopher Ward to share our priorities. He asked for that. And we heard a little bit about his priorities in our region. So that was a very interesting meeting. And we hope to keep those lines of communications open. At this point, I'll turn it over and ask for questions from, if the board has questions of our executive officer concerning his report. I see none. So we'll move on to the consent calendar.
If I could, Chair Cantu, just to add a couple of brief things to the executive officer's report. First of all, three of our staff, Jimmy Smith, Jody Ebsen, and Brian McDaniel, have all been working on contract tracing for the last year, and I'm very proud to report they've done exceedingly well in contributing to the state's response, and they are returning to us, and not a moment too soon. I'd also like to especially thank and congratulate Brian McDaniels, who this month was acknowledged and awarded the status of Contact Tracer of the Month award. He has really demonstrated sensitivity and diligence in his interaction with the public, and I congratulate him and thank him. We could not be more proud of that accomplishment. I'd also ask the board to join me in congratulating Sophie DiCampalto on her retirement after 20 years of service as a water resource control engineer. I would like to advise you and the public to be watching our website. We will be announcing two workshops on the triennial review this summer. On July 20th, there will be a public workshop, and we anticipate having an August 4th tribal workshop on triennial reviews. And then finally, as I believe you are aware, in the interest of long-term planning, the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting has been set. The dates are now October 21st and 22nd. It may be a hybrid meeting, so do stay tuned for that. And we have a discussion item for that if the board needs one for the September board meeting. And unless there are any questions, that concludes my report.
Thank you, Dave. Any questions? Okay, we will move on to the consent calendar. The items on the consent calendar may be removed at the request of any board member or person. If the item is removed from the uncontested items calendar, it will only be voted on at this meeting if the board accepts the staff recommendation for the agenda item. Otherwise, the item will be continued to a subsequent board meeting to allow input by interested persons. We have several items on here. Does anybody, board members, wish to remove any of these items from our uncontested agenda? Are there any members of the public who wish to remove them?
Chair Cantu, I'm not seeing any hands raised at this time, but just as a reminder to the public, if you do wish to address the board, please press star 9 on your phone or use the raise your hand function in Zoom. Taking a moment here, I am not seeing any hands being raised at this time.
Very good. So I'll call for a motion and a second to adopt the consent calendar.
I'll move approval, Betty Olson.
Thank you.
A second.
Thank you. Any discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Dr. Barbineau?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Aye.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
And Chair Cantu?
Aye.
Motion passes.
Thank you. It's 9:58 right now. Let's take a 5-minute break before we move on to the meat of our agenda, and we'll reconvene back here at 10:03 and a half. Thank you. The board will now hear a public hearing to consider tentative order number Region Board 9-2021 number 8. If adopted, the tentative order would approve the terms of the settlement agreement between the prosecution team and the City of Laguna Beach to resolve the alleged violation in the tentative order. Board Member Olson has a statement to give before we begin.
Thank you. I'm on the Board of Directors of the Santa Margarita Water District. The Santa Margarita Water District is a member agency of the South Orange County Wastewater Authority. This proposed settlement agreement and stipulation for entry of administrative civil liability includes an enhanced compliance action. The proposed enhanced compliance action would interconnect a sewer transmission pipeline operated by the City of Laguna Beach with a lift station operated by the South Coast Water District. Both the sewage transmission pipeline and the lift station convey untreated sewage to the South Orange County Wastewater Authority Coastal Treatment Plant. My affiliation with the Santa Margarita Water District and the South Coast and the South Orange County Wastewater Authority will not affect my ability to fairly consider the information presented on this item, and I can and will evaluate the matter on the merits without any regard to my affiliation. Thank you.
And Chair Cantu, if I may, the board has an advisory team for this item. It is composed of Attorney Vincent Vu, Dr. Jill Harris, and myself. We are prepared to offer you a recommendation if you wish at the conclusion of the item.
Chair Cantu, I believe your microphone is muted.
I am so sorry. Now, would you please administer the or provide the instructions on how the oath will be administered?
Gladly. All persons expecting to testify on this item must take the following oath that will be provided by the chair. Since this meeting is taking place virtually over the Zoom platform, we ask that all persons expecting to testify raise your virtual hand by using the Zoom application raise hand feature. Or if you are attending the meeting by phone, press *9 now to raise your hand. After the board chair has administered the oath, you will be asked to lower your hand in Zoom.
Very good, thank you. So I'll give everybody a moment to do your raised hand function, and I see some.
Roger, can you give instructions on how to raise your hand?
Yes. So as a quick reminder, you will press *9 on your phone to raise your hand, or you can use the raise your hand button in the Zoom application.
Can you explain where that is in the Zoom application?
Yes. So if you look at your participation, you can, or your name, you can go ahead and click on the button to raise your hand. It should be at the top of your screen.
Just in an abundance of caution, does anybody who wishes to raise your hand and does not know how to have any questions that we might be able to assist you? We want to be sure everyone who wishes to testify takes the oath of office and does testify. So if anybody's having a problem, please unmute yourself and simply ask for help out loud.
I am having an issue, but I will just raise my hand.
Okay, Kelly, appreciate that. Okay, at this point, we ask that all persons expecting to testify raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is the truth? If so, say I do. and you're all muted, so I can't hear you, but I saw a lot of lips move, so I believe you. And I also assume all those hands are, in fact, right hands. So now you may lower your hand in the virtual, your virtual hand in Zoom. Kelly, you can lower your real hand. Before testifying, please state your name, your affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. We will hear testimony from our board staff first, and then the discharger, and then interested persons after that. So we'll open the floor now for our board staff.
Good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. First of all, how's the sound?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Great. Okay, my name is Chiara Clemente. I'm a senior environmental scientist with the Compliance Assurance Unit. And I'm coming to you today from a hotel in Colorado. So I apologize in advance for any internet issues that we might run into. But okay, so on behalf of the prosecution team, I'm here to present item 8. Roger, hopefully you can queue up. Perfect. This is tentative order R9-2021-0008, which is a settlement agreement and stipulation for entry of administrative civil liability order, or in plain language, it's a settlement agreement between the City of Laguna Beach, or City, and the San Diego Water Board's prosecution team to address liability associated with the unauthorized discharge of approximately 1.7 million gallons of untreated sewage to Aliso Creek, Bluebird Beach, and the Pacific Ocean from November 27 to 29 in 2019. Other members of the prosecution team include Laura Drabant, which is our counsel with the Office of Enforcement, Healthy Waters Branch Manager Jeremy Haas, and our Assistant Executive Officer Kelly Dorsey, all here today. Not here today is our lead investigator for this case, Rebecca Stewart, who retired last September, but deserves much of the credit. Keith Yeager with the Core Regulatory Unit is also available to answer any questions about the permit requirements. And with us today from the City of Laguna Beach are City Manager John Pedig and Director of Water Quality Dave Schisler, who will both be presenting after me in that order, as well as outside counsel Pat Chen. Next slide, please. As part of your agenda package, you should have received the following 7 supporting documents. Okay, next slide, please. This enforcement action that you're considering today was developed in response to a large sewer spill into marine protected areas and areas of high recreational use. As part of my presentation, I plan to provide you with an overview of the sanitary sewer overflow, which I'll use the word SSO, relative to these key areas, the violations alleged, a summary of the penalty, and an overview of the comments received. Then I will turn it over to the city to provide a summary and status report on the proposed Enhanced Compliance Action, or ECA. Next slide, please. This is a map of Laguna Beach area. Aliso Creek is recognized by the city as an environmentally sensitive area and by the Water Board as a key area for habitats and ecosystems. It is shown on the map as traveling southwest from the Compass Rose and then taking a westerly heading and meeting up with the Pacific Ocean at Orange County's Aliso Beach Park. And Roger, if you have the ability, thank you, to use the mouse to point to those areas. All right, so that's the NCI, I'm getting there. At the Pacific Ocean, there are 2 marine protected areas, the Laguna Beach State Marine Conservation Area and the Laguna Beach State Marine Reserve. Both of these are key areas for recreations and habitat and ecosystem. Now the red line, I hope you can see, is the North Coast Interceptor, or NCI. It conveys sewage south and then east through the Ben Brown Golf Course in the ranch to SOQWA's, or South Orange County's Wastewater Authority's, coastal treatment plant, which eventually gets discharged through the Aliso Creek Ocean Outfall, just outside the Laguna Beach State Marine Conservation Area. All right, So at 11:30 a.m. on November 27, 2019, as most people were making their Thanksgiving preparations, personnel from the Ben Brown Golf Course provided notice that sewage was flowing from a utility vault along the NCI. The vault is located at a pinch point in Aliso Canyon, adjacent to Aliso Creek. It's the green arrow from the box titled Aliso Spill. Response staff were on site and fully engaged within 2 hours. Shortly after the spill was identified, it started to rain. That night, during low flow conditions, the city attempted to empty the vault, but sewage flows were too great to sufficiently lower the level and gain visual confirmation of the source of the SSO. As a result, the spill continued discharging to Aliso Creek while the city regrouped and determined the best course of action. It was decided that during the next evening and low flow period, sewage flows would be rerouted to a storm drain at the Bluebird lift station, that's in the upper left of your picture, to drain the NCI and allow the city to identify and repair the cause of the SSO. The Bluebird storm drain discharges to the Pacific Ocean at Bluebird Beach. In accordance with the State Board's general waste discharge requirements for sanitary sewer systems, the two spill locations are treated as one SSO event. Next slide, please. With the Bluebird bypass in place, response staff were able to drain the NCI, identify and repair the problem, and terminate the bypass within 12 hours, wrapping up the SSO on November 29th at 12:30 p.m. The cause of the SSO was determined to be a corroded air vacuum relief valve, which resulted in a pressurized discharge from the 3-inch diameter area. The city timely submitted spill response information in accordance with its waste discharge requirements, including preliminary volume estimations, followed by a revised volume estimation totaling 1.87 million gallons on January 13th, 2020, with its required 45-day report. All of the city's required spill response documentation is housed in the Water Board's CWIX database and available to the public. As part of its investigation, the prosecution team asked State Water Board's Special Investigation Unit to independently analyze the city's January 13th volume calculations. Based on follow-up actions prompted by their analysis, including pump curve calibrations, on February 18th, 2020, the city submitted a revised volume estimate totaling 1.7 million gallons. Next slide, please. The approximate volume discharge to Aliso Creek from the pinch point was 1.27 million gallons, and the discharge to Bluebird Beach was an additional 430,000 gallons. After getting to the sufficient approximation of the volume discharge, discussions shifted focus to other aspects of our investigation, including how the city managed and implemented its capital improvement projects, whether the city bore culpability for not having implemented redundancy along the NCI, analyzing available data to assess actual harm to the receiving waters, and discussing corrective actions that could prevent or minimize a similar overflow. Our findings are reflected in our penalty assessment and summarized in the technical analysis, which is attachment A to the settlement order. Next slide, please. The tentative order finds that the city's discharge of raw sewage from November 27 to 29, 2019 was in violation of the Clean Water Act and California Water Code, which prohibit the discharge of pollutants to surface waters except in compliance with NPDES permits. The discharge was also in violation of Basin Plan Waste Discharge Prohibition Number 1, which prohibits the discharge of waste to waters of the state in a matter causing or threatening to cause a condition of pollution, contamination, or nuisance, and Prohibition 9, which states the unauthorized discharge of treated or untreated waters, sewage to waters of the state or stormwater conveyance system is prohibited. And the discharge of raw sewage was also in violation of the prohibitions in the statewide and regional waste discharge requirements for sanitary sewer systems. Next slide, please. After reviewing the city's 45-day report, in March of 2020, the prosecution team and the city entered into confidential settlement negotiations to resolve the alleged violations arising from the SSO. The parties agreed to settle this matter without administrative or civil litigation by presenting the settlement to the San Diego Water Board for adoption. The tentative order assesses an administrative civil liability totaling approximately $1.5 million, including roughly $38,000 in staff costs to September of 2020, which is when the parties reached a settlement in concept. Of that $1.5 million, a little over half would be paid to the State Water Board's Cleanup and Abatement Account Fund within 30 days of order adoption, and the remaining half would be treated as a suspended liability upon successful completion of a proposed ECA, which is intended to minimize the risk of a similar SSO from occurring in the area. The city also agrees to pay an additional $6,000 to the cleanup and abatement account for the San Diego Water Board staff's oversight of the proposed ECA for the next 3 years. This includes tasks such as updating regulatory and records databases, reviewing and evaluating progress, conducting site inspections, reviewing the final completion report, and verifying appropriate expenditure of suspended liability funds. The penalty, slide nine, please. Okay, so the penalty amount was calculated using the methodology in the 2017 Water Quality Enforcement Policy. The factors selected are further detailed in Attachment A of the tentative order. The total base liability was calculated at roughly $1.7 million. It's important to note that settlement negotiations occurred through the peak of the pandemic. During that time, the City Council adopted a mid-year budget revise to reflect anticipated revenue shortfalls as a result of the pandemic. The city reduced its annual budget by approximately 12%. In consideration of these revenue shortfalls and financial uncertainties, the prosecution team agreed to reduce the proposed total base liability amount proportionately, which is roughly $200,000, as a settlement consideration under other factors as justice may require. A draft of the tentative order with a notice of 30-day comment period was initiated on February 5, 2021. At the close of the written comment period on March 12, 2021, the San Diego Water Board timely received 8 written comment letters. On Monday, May 31, Roger Buto of Clean Water Now submitted written comments via email. I understand that the chair has declined to accept this late comment letter into the record for this matter. So a summary response document was provided to the commenting parties and public on May 10 of 2021. Some of the comments received were not directly related to issues in the tentative order, such as suggestions on alternative alignments for wastewater conveyance, treatment, and recycling, or voter representation. These comments were shared with the city for their consideration, and commenting parties have been encouraged to provide these comments through the appropriate public processes. Our responses were focused on matters relating to the spill, the applicable policies and permit requirements, the alleged violations, and the settlement conditions. Next slide, please. Most of the comments we received focused on the proposed ECA. Most notably, during the public comment period, it was revealed that the South Coast Water District's Lift Station 2 reconstruction project, to which the proposed intertie ECA is piggybacking on, included a permanent road realignment that may impede relocation of parking for future restoration of the Aliso Creek estuary as proposed by the Laguna Ocean Foundation. Since that time, the city, the South Coast Water District, Laguna Ocean Foundation, and other relevant stakeholders have met to determine whether the Lift Station 2 reconstruction project could be modified to accommodate future restoration, and or whether the restoration conceptual design could be modified with other parking design alternatives. This will take some time to resolve. Meanwhile, South Coast Water District revised their planning documents to reflect that the road realignment is not permanent and they are open to modifying the road alignment later if a restoration design that is agreeable to all stakeholders can be developed. We have asked we have invited stakeholders to speak on this matter as commenting parties, including the South Coast Water District and the Laguna Ocean Foundation. Altogether, the prosecution team believes that all responsive written comments received have been addressed in the record. Next, the city will describe the ECA in greater detail and report on progress related to these discussions. After that, we would be happy to answer any questions from the board. And after you hear from all the speakers, the prosecution team would like the opportunity to come back and address any outstanding issues.
Very good. Thank you very much for that. And we will do that. We will invite you back at the end. At this point, we'll invite John Pedick, city manager of the city of Laguna Beach, to present. Thank you.
Thank you and good morning. I am John Pedick, the city manager, and I did take the oath. I also would like to thank Kiera for her thorough presentation this morning. It is very disheartening that we are before you today to discuss a sewage spill. Over the last 20 years, the city has worked extremely hard to improve its sewer system and has significantly reduced sewer spills. However, in spite of our efforts, a 1.7 million gallon sewage spill occurred in November of 2019 during the Thanksgiving holiday and a significant rain event. The spill emanated from a decommissioned air release valve, which had been replaced several years earlier. Unfortunately, the plug that remained in the pipe failed and a sewage spill occurred. Laguna Beach understands the importance of preventing sewage spills and protecting the marine environment. Following this spill, the city commissioned an assessment of the North Coast Interceptor to examine potential improvements to the sewer system, including the possible installation of a duplicate transmission pipe that very few agencies have today. In addition, the city and the neighboring South Coast Water District embarked on a project to allow the mutual use of each agency's transmission mains within Aliso Canyon. This project will minimize the risk of future sewage spills for both agencies and is the enhanced compliance action project that is before you today as part of the settlement proposal. The Laguna Beach City Council also authorized the city staff to pursue five consecutive sewer fee increases of 6% each year to fund additional improvements to the sewer system. The city understands that the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board has a responsibility to review sewage spills and penalize agencies. While the city regrets the spill and the significant penalty, we appreciate the professional approach taken by your team to address this difficult matter. The city stands behind the settlement reached with your staff and looks forward to putting the matter behind us and focusing on further improvements to the wastewater system. Thank you for your time today and your service on the board. At this time, I would like to introduce David Schisler, the city's Director of Water Quality, who will provide more details regarding the Enhanced Compliance Action Project. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pedick. We appreciate your responsiveness as well. Mr. Schisler?
Yes, good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the Regional Board. I am David Schisler, Director of Water Quality, and I did take the vow. The city is glad to represent additional information as it relates to the Enhanced Compliance Action. Along with our city manager and with us today in support of the ECA are members of the South Coast Water District, South Orange County Wastewater Authority, Emerald Bay Service District, the Ranch Resort, and the city's technical team. I'd like to thank Chiara Clemente and the prosecution staff for working with the city to conduct a very thorough investigation. The effort resulted in a fair and reasonable ACL settlement agreement. The following slides that have been prepared to provide better details on the North Coast Interceptor and its intertie project. Next slide, please. As Chiara had mentioned earlier, the North Coast Interceptor is the city's wastewater transmission pipeline that transmits about 2 million gallons a day. It runs approximately 4 miles from downtown Laguna Beach near City Hall, south, paralleling Coast Highway, and it continues to the Aliso Beach County Park and then turn sharply up Canyon along Country Club Drive to the South Orange County Wastewater Authority's Coastal Treatment Plant. Next slide, please, Roger. As mentioned by our city manager, in response to the 2019 spill, the city council directed our staff to prepare a North Coast Interceptor Reliability Assessment Study. The results of that study, along with a comprehensive capital improvement program, was developed and presented to the City Council in a workshop that we presented to them in February of 2021. The list of those resulting actions is listed here in the slide, but I will take the time just to highlight some of the highlights. A peer review exercise was conducted to evaluate further options that may improve the recommendations of the NCI reliability study. Additionally, the city will also conduct a physical assessment of the NCI to conduct destructive testing and physical confirmation of the integrity of the pipeline along its length. As John had previously mentioned, the City Council has authorized staff to engage a protest vote process pursuant to the compliance of Prop 218 to increase sewer rates at 6% in each of the next 5 years and authorize pursuing low interest loans. The city manager was further authorized to execute a contract with the South Coast Water District for the intertie project associated with Lift Station Number 2 reconstruction project, which is, of course, the enhanced compliance action about which we are speaking. Next slide, please, Roger. The results of the NCI reliability study identified the Aliso Creek section along the transmission pipeline to be the highest priority of all the improvements along the NCI. As identified in this slide, the study identifies Reach 5 as the which will include a fully redundant system that provides the highest level of reliability for its maintenance and operation. Next slide, please. By definition, an enhanced compliance action is a project that hasn't previously been programmed. Because the city maintains a 10-year capital improvement program that addresses the most significant wastewater system projects, we were challenged to identify a project that benefits the area in the same vicinity of the spill. We were very glad, therefore, to identify the intertie project that meets the expectations of the ECA. Next slide, please. As shown in this slide, the Up Canyon aerial perspective gives a view of the last mile of the Aliso Creek from Pacific Ocean on the right, on the bottom right, and up Aliso Creek to the coastal treatment plant at the top left. Thanks, Roger. Next slide, please. From a plan view, we show the same mile and have highlighted the pipeline for which the intertie project will provide bypass capability. It's basically from that star all the way up the canyon to the coastal treatment plant. And notably, about halfway up that length is the location of the sewer spill. So you can see this is a direct benefit. Next slide, please. Zooming in a little closer, we're showing that where the existing lift station number 2 sits, as well as the site of the new facility. You can see that on the flags there. Roger's showing you where the old and the new are there. And the dashed white line is where the intertie project will be constructed. At this point in time, the design is nearly complete. The South Coast Water District has completed the mitigated negative declaration process and is on track to complete the project as planned. Next slide, please. So to sum up, the enhanced compliance action provides multiple benefits. It creates a pipeline bypass system allowing the Laguna Beach and the South Coast Water District to conduct inspection and maintenance operations. It provides emergency bypass capabilities in the event of a problem developing. Having two agencies sharing facilities creates a workforce multiplier. The intertie project serves to safeguard the coastline from Dana Point to Newport Beach, which reflects the extent of the initial closure following the spill. It will directly protect the environment along the last mile of Aliso Creek, and it protects the marine life, the beachgoers, and the public safety personnel at Aliso Beach County Park. Next slide, please. As mentioned by Chiara Clemente, the city, along with the South Coast Water District, County of Orange, and the Ranch Resort, we are all working with representatives from the Laguna Ocean Foundation in development of a concept plan for an estuary project. Those discussions are ongoing, and the participants are seeking solutions to further develop the estuary concept. While there are many details to be addressed, the discussions remain productive. Next slide, please. And with that, I conclude our presentation and remain available for questions. And I thank the board very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Schisler. Does the board have any questions now for either Ms. Clemente or Mr. Pettick or Mr. Schisler? Hearing none. Oh, I do see Henry's hand is up.
I had a question for Chiara.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Sometimes we have seen SEPs associated with these considerations. Has such a potential project been discussed with the city of Laguna Beach or with whoever we need to do that? And what's happening?
Yes, as the record will indicate, we did discuss the option of SEPs for this particular settlement action. I think I will reiterate what I've said in other conversations is that the SEP criteria require that there be a direct nexus to the violation, that the SEP be completed within 3 years and have tangible and discrete environmental benefits. Therefore, those are very limiting criteria to have direct environmental benefits, particularly for the purposes of our priorities of restoration, direct environmental benefits within 3 years. So yes, it was discussed.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Cantu, I believe your microphone is muted.
I am so sorry. Thank you. I think I called for any other questions. And Ms. Clemente, do you have anything you'd like to add before we move to public comments?
No, just the opportunity to address any new comments at the end.
Thank you. Very good. So at this point, we'll invite public comments. Roger, will you call for any public comments and introduce each speaker? Public commenters will have 3 minutes each to present their remarks.
Thank you, Board Chair Cantu. If any member of the public would like to speak, please virtually raise your hand in Zoom by pressing the raise your hand function or press *9 on your phone now. Please remember to state your name for the record before you speak. Currently, we have five commenters. First up will be Betty Burnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Cantu and members of the board for the opportunity to participate. My name is Betty Burnett. I'm the general manager of the South Orange County Wastewater Authority. I'm available to you to answer any questions that you may have for us. But my comment is to support the action and implementation as set forth in the settlement. That's the end of my comment.
Thank you very much.
John Elliers.
Hello. My name is John Elliers. I'm a resident of Laguna Beach, and I want to relate to the board two items of information that pertain to the Water Board's deliberations. The first is my recent experience as a member of a group that toured the Aliso Creek Coastal Treatment Plant. I was fortunate to meet all the great folks who worked there, and it struck me that the first information we were given at the safety briefing before the tour was that if anyone saw smoke, we were to alert the staff and everyone would be evacuated from the facility as quickly as possible. We were told that because of its location, there was no possibility of fighting a wildfire and that none of the facilities except the main office building would be safe to shelter in. I also learned that the surrounding canyon area is 100 years overdue for a wildfire. That's an enormous amount of fuel that is surrounding the treatment plant. I'm very concerned that as wildfires become more and more prevalent in our area, the treatment plant is increasingly vulnerable. I was also told it was not possible to harden the coastal treatment plant against such wildfires. I hope the board will consider this information when considering modernizing this infrastructure that is under ever-increasing existential threat. The second item I wish to relate is that the Laguna Bluebelt Coalition recently conducted a public opinion survey on water issues in Laguna Beach. One of the questions asked how much per month respondents would be willing to pay to support a treatment process that fully recycled all of Laguna's wastewater. The average of all responses was $15.88. Even if that number were reduced to $10 a month, residents collectively said that they would be willing to provide approximately $35 million over the next 30 years to achieve the worthy goal of fully recycling and reusing our city's wastewater. I hope the board will consider these facts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Roger, will you call on our next?
Yes. Armita Arino?
Hello, my name is Armita Arellano. I'm speaking on behalf of Orange County Coastkeeper, which is a public benefit corporation with members dedicated to the preservation and protection of environment and natural resources in Orange County. We support the proposed Enhanced Compliance Action Intertie Project and its ability to prevent an overflow of this magnitude from occurring again. However, we urge the board and the City of Laguna Beach to consider dispersing even a small portion of the suspended liability amount in order to fund one of the many supplemental environmental projects, or SEPs, designated for this region. For almost 20 years, the City of Laguna Beach was aware of the risks associated with leaving a decommissioned air vacuum relief valve intact, but decidedly chose to avoid fixing this issue, which saved them almost $260,000 in construction costs and allowed them to avoid disrupting a nearby ranch and golf course. The city seemingly prioritized aesthetics and monetary savings over the potential impact a sewage spill of this magnitude could have over local ecosystems, wildlife, and human health. The suspended liability amount would be better served if it was dispersed to one of the water board's listed SEPs, because the South Orange County area has demonstrable need for such funding. For example, one SEP provides for the collection and evaluation of data in order to restore and protect the San Juan Creek estuary. The San Juan Creek is a 29-mile stream that drains a watershed of 134 square miles, which has 16 major native plant communities and hundreds of animal species. The practice of gathering data is a valuable tool that would allow for beneficial uses of our local waterways and to protect the ecosystems that support biodiversity. Similarly, there are a variety of other SEPs that would significantly benefit from and be successfully accomplished by even a small portion of the suspended liability amount in question, including beach cleanups at Aliso State Beach, which is the affected area. We urge you to consider dispersing some of the suspended liability amount to fund a local SEP. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you.
Mark Cerna.
Good morning. Can you hear me? Over.
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you and good morning. My name is Mark Cerna. I'm the chief engineer with the South Coast Water District. So on behalf of the South Coast Water District, we appreciate the opportunity comment on this proposed tentative order. So the South Coast Water District supports this partnership with the City of Laguna Beach to provide an intertie between the North Coast Interceptor and the district's Lift Station Number 2 reconstruction project. This NCI interconnect, as identified in the ECA, would provide the city with the ability to bypass sewage flows to our Lift Station Number 2, which we refer to as LS2, and our LS2 force main system. And it will also allow the district to bypass flows in the future if needed. To ensure a reliable sewage conveyance system for our customers and to minimize the risk of sewer overflows, the district recently completed the LS2 Force Main project, and we will continue to invest additional significant capital into our LS2 replacement project, which is in the final design stages, and it's slated to be completed in late 2024. So we feel this partnership to incorporate the Intertie project into the district's LS2 project will bring value to both agencies and our customers. While the district would implement the Intertie project as part of our LS2 project, it is understood that the city will be directly involved in the Intertie portion of this project, its funding, and be fully responsible for meeting all ECA commitments. The district and the city, with the South Orange County Wastewater Authority as owner of the NCI, are currently negotiating an agreement to memorialize respective terms and conditions with respect to the Intertie project. So the district appreciates the Water Board's consideration of these comments and the opportunity to partner with the city on this Intertie project. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Dunbar.
Good morning, Chair Cantu and members of the board. My name is Michael Dunbar. I'm the general manager of Emerald Bay Service District, and I'm also a professional engineer. We are partners, Emerald Bay Service District, with the City of Laguna Beach in its North Coast Interceptor, and we fully support the settlement, and we support the intertie that the city is pursuing with South Coast Water District. So I would like to thank the board for this opportunity, and also thank the board for supporting the settlement agreement with the City of Laguna Beach. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our final commenter is Ed Almanzana.
Mr. Almanza, I see you are logged in, but you are muted.
There I am. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, board members. Ed Almanza with Laguna Ocean Foundation. We are partners and co-funders, along with the State Coastal Conservancy, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the City of Laguna Beach, in the planning for the restoration of the Aliso Creek Estuary. The Aliso Estuary Restoration Project is widely supported by local and regional stakeholders, including many NGOs. The project is in the site design stage, as Dave Schistler mentioned, and the effort now is to take the conceptual restoration plan completed in 2018 to a more specific site design, a process that necessitates the participation and collaboration of landowners and key stakeholders. The restoration of the Aliso Estuary aligns with the goals of the regional board in many ways. The basin plan identifies the estuary as a beneficial use and calls for its restoration. The South Orange County WQIP specifically calls out the restored estuary as an important consideration in its MS4 implementation priorities. And restoration of Aliso Estuary is a high priority of the state's wetlands recovery project, of which the regional board is a participating member along with other key resource agencies in the state. I'd like to thank your staff, in particular Chiara Clementi, for working so closely with us. And I also want to thank all of your staff for being so supportive of the estuary restoration project. The Laguna Ocean Foundation supports moving ahead with the settlement agreement. We have stated our support many times. Staff has asked us to speak today specifically on the question of whether or not the tentative order or the very closely aligned lift station project proposed by South Coast Water District would impede future restoration of the estuary. This is an important question. As the city's proposed intertie project is joined at the hip with the lift station project, we need to consider the two together. South Coast Water District has only recently begun to participate in the planning process for the estuary, and our process was delayed for more than a year while we waited for the district to respond to the request to participate. Only after the intertie and lift station projects became public did they agree to attend meetings to discuss the estuary, and those meetings are now ongoing. For this reason, we find it very difficult to give a definitive answer to the question posed by staff. It is unclear what land use entitlements South Coast Water District is requesting from the city in association with the conditional use permit and coastal development permit required for the lift station project. It is equally unclear what entitlements the city will grant. In our latest communication with the city, we were told the project application for the lift station has not been deemed complete, and the city is working with the district to define the requested actions. Given this uncertainty, our recommendation is that the board approve the tentative order and that we all look to see what steps South Coast Water District and the city take in the near future. I do not recommend delaying the city's intertie project. Your staff has asked us to give an update to this board in September on the estuary restoration project. I would hope that at that time, we will all know more about the willingness and success of key stakeholders to develop a feasible site plan for restoring the estuary that satisfies all stakeholders' needs. I want to thank the city and the other stakeholders for participating. I'm happy to answer any questions and urge the board to move forward with the agreement.
Thank you, Mr. Almanza. And we look forward to that September report. And I would hope that all the interested parties, including South Coast and the cities, attend that meeting so that we can have a full understanding of the progress. The restoration of the Aliso Estuary is very important and is something that people have been looking forward to for a very long time. Ms. Clemente?
Chair Cantu, we do have one more comment.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
This one is a telephone comment. So the individual associated with the 367 phone number, please go ahead and address the board.
Hello, this is Mike Bean in South Laguna. Is it working?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
We
it's
can
very
hear
unfortunate.
You. I neglected to ask some of the previous speakers if they had taken the oath, and so I need to at least ask you.
Yes, I have.
Thank you.
Yes, Mike Bean in South Laguna. It's very unfortunate the burden to challenge the proposed settlement agreement for the discharge of close to 2 million gallons of raw sewage to Laguna's marine protected areas is left to the citizens of South Laguna living in the impact zone. The community and the regional board now have an opportunity to modernize the coastal treatment plant per city resolution of 2014, or retire the remote facility for a safer, more efficient system. Please deny the settlement agreement. Since it takes funds designed for environmental restoration to pay for a sewer pipe intertie necessary to deal with sewer pipes scattered along and sometimes under Aliso Creek. An Army Corps of Engineers project in 2005 estimated the cost to protect sewer pipes would cost $100 million. The Thanksgiving raw sewage discharges are a wake-up call and the direct result of deferred maintenance and a poorly sited coastal treatment plant located at the bottom of a four-mile-long valley ending in a steep canyon with walls approaching 1,000 feet. Even the mayor of Laguna Beach has testified that the coastal treatment plant would never be built at its present location since it's located in remote, extremely high wildfire hazard area mapped by CAL FIRE, has difficult accessibility for emergencies, and lacks reliable communication for a quick response to sewer pipes slowly deteriorating from age and neglect. The California Water Code defines an SEP as an environmentally beneficial project that a person agrees to undertake with the approval of the regional board, which would not be undertaken in the absence of an enforcement action. While a bypass is not an industry standard, few treatment plants are sited a mile inland in a remote wilderness area. SEPs can also help to further the Water Board's mission for the protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses. Part of this mission includes ensuring environmental justice and addressing climate change. The City of Laguna presently has zero recycle water for its 1.87 million gallons sent to the treatment plant. Environmental justice considers the fair treatment of all people. South Laguna citizens are denied voting rights on water and sewer issues while experiencing the full impacts of sewer operations of the city and the entire Aliso watershed of over 2.5 million residents, discharging a daily average of 10 million gallons of secondary sewage just 1.5 miles off of Aliso Beach. South Laguna citizens are directly impacted by violations, yet are not allowed a role as a key stakeholder in confidential settlement negotiations. Climate change projects must address building resilience to climate change impacts on ecosystems, such as the dwindling areas of nearby kelp forests suffering from sewage impacts and neglect. In today's world of rapid climate change, kelp forests play a pivotal role by growing as much as 2 feet per day to sequester carbon and should be included in the SEP. The mandates to modernize the 50-year-old coastal treatment plant to address climate change and ensure environmental justice for the 5,000 South Laguna citizens and millions of visitors from regional disadvantaged communities to local beaches requires denial of the proposed settlement agreement as a way to open up genuine representation of key stakeholders and development of actual ecosystem restoration within the raw sewage impact areas. Please deny the settlement agreement that takes precious economic resources away from improving the environment to pay for necessary repairs that have been deteriorated from a poorly designed sewage system suffering decades of neglect and poor maintenance. As always, South Laguna citizens are ready and willing to help advance sustainable solutions to ocean pollution. Thank you for your dedication to environmental justice, climate change, and advancing genuine ecosystem opportunities through the supplemental environmental projects aimed at addressing and promoting healthier coastal receiving waters under your jurisdiction. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Thank you. We'll open it up for questions now from the board of all of our public speakers. Don't see any hands up, so I'll invite Ms. Clemente to respond, and then we'll circle back to our board members.
Okay, I don't think we heard any new comments today. I think a lot of the comments have already been addressed in the written record to the extent that they can be. So I just want to remind the board that you heard comments today with regards to the location of the coastal treatment plant and the ability to do or not do reclamation. And I would just remind you that those are beyond the scope of the settlement. Those are with different parties and different permits, and they're not the reason this SSO occurred. So I just want to focus the scope on what we have here today. And then with regards to the, I think we continue to hear concerns that the SEP fund, sorry, that the suspended liability funds could be better spent as SEPs. And I wish that were true, but the reality is there are, in the prosecution team's opinion, there are no better qualified projects for this particular settlement because of the restrictions of the SEP policy, because of the location. So for example, you heard San Juan Creek restoration get discussed, but that's in the same boat in terms of being a planning project without the ability to do restoration within 3 years. And just a reminder, the current ECA maximizes the amount of suspended liability, so no additional funds are available to do a smaller SEP or like a beach cleanup or anything like that. So that's what we have here today. And nevertheless, the prosecution team would still recommend adoption of the tentative settlement order or of the settlement order. That concludes my comments. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Clemente. Board members? Just to review, the administrative civil liability totals $1,534,058. That is calculated consistent with our standard formula. Of that, the city of Laguna agrees to remit a check of $785,780.50. The suspended amount of the full amount is $748,277.50. And the expectation and critical to this settlement includes that the enhanced compliance action costing approximately $1.4 million would be invested. So the amount that is suspended is a portion, not slightly more than half of the total investment that they are required to make. Any questions about that? Hearing no more questions, I'll ask the executive officer if he or his staff have any comments.
Thank you, Chair Cantu. The advisory team has reviewed the complaint and the tentative settlement order, the compliance factors in the penalty calculator, the enhanced compliance alternative that was proposed, as well as the comments from the public and agencies and the prosecution team's responses to those. With all of that information, we recommend the adoption of the tentative order R9-2021-0008.
Thank you. So at this time, we'll close the public hearing for this item.
I think Eric has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see that. Go ahead.
You're muted.
No. I had a question for Kiara, and it was just I hadn't over all the years seen a duplicate transmission line proposal for a way to fortify infrastructure for sewage. This is a fairly unique, I have every confidence that you guys believe it'll work.
So I may not be the best person to ask if it's unique. This particular intertie is the first I've encountered in terms of the technology. However, redundancy is not. In other words, what I have encountered is frequently when the systems are getting upgraded, they look to do a double sleeve or a new line, and they leave the old line in place to create redundancy. The intertie is unique just because of the unique situation of the two force mains being co-located. Does that answer your question?
Okay, last call, Ms. Olson, Dr. Olson.
Yes, I wanted to say that I did ask about the SEPs because I saw that they had been requested. And I was informed by the executive officer that the SEPs didn't meet the goals of the project, or the requirements, I should say the requirements, and that the alternative, and I agree with Mr. Anderson, although somewhat unique, will indeed solve the problem. But I just want to know that we're sensitive to the issues that were raised. Thank you.
That's a very strong point. There are many compelling SEPs that we would love to get funded. We need, more revenue from not just SEPs, but also from bonds and other local investment. Maybe the infrastructure bill, federal infrastructure bill, might give us some money there. We don't know. But there is a tremendous long list of very compelling SEPs that we would like to see funded. So if there are no more comments, I will close the public portion of this item and the board will deliberate. Do we have a motion and a second to put this on the floor and we'll deliberate?
So moved.
Thank you, Ms. Blair. Board Member Bolar.
I'll second the motion.
Thank you, Dr. Olson. We have a second. Any further discussion?
Yes. So I don't, it's not directly about the terms of this agreement, but I think it's a really valuable point that was made that the narrow focus of the board today, which is to say the violation before us, the cause of the violation and whether the settlement terms are just. But I do think it's worth the board considering at another time when we can have that broader conversation about, is there a treatment plant in a wildfire hazard area? And if so, what are the long-term consequences for water quality in our region? And what are the climate change sustainability questions we should ask about these specific infrastructure pieces that were pointed out to us today? So I just think we should put that you know, on the agenda for another day. And since we're been, I think, correctly advised that that's not appropriate for discussion now.
Yeah, I agree. That's really important. There are many climate change impacts, wildfires being one, sea level intrusion being another. So I don't know if there's been any comprehensive analysis done, but I think that's something that we have got to get on top of. Thank you very much for that. Additional comments or questions, deliberation? Hearing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Dr. Barbanel? Did he leave?
No, he's muted.
Okay. Mr. Anderson? Oh, there you are, Henry.
Yeah, no, yes.
Okay, Mr. Anderson?
Aye.
Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye. So motion carries. Is it the will of the board to have a short 5-minute break before we do our next item? Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. It is now 11:05. We'll reconvene at 11:10. Thank you. And remind people, if you do not mute yourself, we can hear, and you are broadcasting to the World Wide Web, all of your background information. So I might suggest that you definitely mute yourself. On a short break, let's reconvene. Okay, there we go. Welcome back. Our next item, number 9, is the master recycling permit. Master recycling permit for the South Bay Water Reclamation Facility, City of San Diego, San Diego County, tentative order number, Regional Board 9, 2021, number 15. The board will now hold a public hearing to consider tentative order Region 9, 2021, number 15. If adopted, the tentative order will replace multiple separate orders with a single order and update the facility's outdated discharge monitoring and reporting requirements. We'll now administer the oath. And Roger, will you please remind people how they need to, what they need to do to have the oath administered?
Yes, all persons expecting to testify on this item must take the following oath that will be provided by the board chair. Since this meeting is taking place virtually over the Zoom platform, we ask that all persons expecting to testify raise your virtual hand using the Zoom application raise hand feature, or if you are attending the meeting by phone, please press *9 now to raise your hand. After the board chair has administered the oath, you will be asked to lower your hand in Zoom.
Okay, has everybody raised their hand that who need to? I see 3 hands. Yeah, I see 3 hands. Okay, I ask that all persons expecting to testify raise your right hand or virtual hand. And Mr. Neal, I see you now. And take the following oath. Do you swear the testimony you are about to give is truth? If so, say I do. And I can read lips, so that's good. You may now lower your virtual hand in Zoom. Before testifying, please state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. We will hear testimony from the board staff, the discharger, and interested persons today. I did see our staff pop up, and I think he went away. Brandon, are you ready to go?
I am ready.
Okay, go ahead.
Are you all seeing my presentation?
We do.
Great. Hello, Board Chair Cantu and fellow members of the board. My name is Brandon Bushnell, and I'm a water resource control engineer in the Groundwater Protection Unit here at the San Diego Water Board, and I have taken the oath. I will be presenting on item number 9, tentative master recycling permit for the City of San Diego's South Bay Water Reclamation Plant. If adopted, the order would replace
Order number 2000-203, Waste Discharge and Water Recycling Requirements for the Production and Purveyance of Recycled Water for the City of San Diego, South Bay Water Reclamation Plant, MNRP number 2000-203, Addendum number 1, and Addendum number 2 to that order. Here you can see an outline of my presentation and the different topics I will be covering. I will plan on giving some background and context and then elaborating on the significant technical changes between the current WDR and the tentative order. To start, I would like to use this overview of the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant to illustrate the different orders the facility is regulated under. The sewer collection system is regulated by General Order Number R9-2007-005. The discharges of secondary treated effluent and excess recycled water to the ocean outfall are both regulated under NPDES Order Number R9-2021-0011, which the board adopted this May. The production of recycled water is currently regulated under Order Number 2000-203, the MNRP 2000-203, Addendum Number 1, and Addendum Number 2, as I described in my opening slide. Recycled water purveyance and use is currently regulated under the Statewide General Order Reclamation Requirements, Order Number 2016-0068-DDW, because the WRRs in the original order are no longer current. Therefore, when we received the revised ROWD from the city, the decision was made to combine all of the orders and addendums and the MNRP into a master recycling order that will cover all of the recycled water activities at the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant, as pictured here. Next, I would like to give some background on the facility. The South Bay Water Reclamation Plant is owned and operated by the City of San Diego and is located in the western portion of the Tijuana River Valley on the southeast corner of Dairy Mart and Monument Road in the City of San Diego. The facility treats wastewater collected from the southern part of the City of San Diego, San Ysidro, Otay Mesa, and Tijuana River Valley, portions of the cities of Imperial Beach and Chula Vista, as well as unincorporated portions of South and East County San Diego. The wastewater collected is primarily domestic sewage from residential and commercial sources. The facility's treatment processes include screening, grit removal, primary sedimentation, primary effluent flow equalization, aeration tanks, coagulation, filtration, and UV disinfection. The city disposes of excess recycled water when recycled water demands are low and secondary treated wastewater to the Pacific Ocean outfall through the South Bay Ocean outfall. The Water Board regulates this discharge, as I previously stated, under Order Number R9-2021-0011. Recycled water produced at South Bay Water Reclamation Plant is sold to customers in the Otay Valley and Tijuana Valley hydrologic areas. The city supplies recycled water produced at the South Bay plant to its customers for landscape irrigation, industrial processes, construction, restricted recreational impoundments, and landscape impoundments. The map below shows the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant's recycled water distribution system. And the majority of the recycled water produced is sold to Otay Municipal Water District, who also produces and distributes its own recycled water from the Ralph W. Chapman Water Reclamation Facility. Adoption of the tentative order is consistent with the goals of the Sustainable Local Water Supply chapter of the San Diego Water Board's practical vision because it consolidates the city's requirements, making regulatory compliance simpler. The reissuance of WDRs and WRRs as the master recycling permit allows the city to continue ongoing efforts to conserve potable water supplies and provide the region with recycled water. There's a lot of information in this figure I borrowed from the San Diego County Water Authority, so I'd like to highlight exactly what type of water we are discussing are the different sources named in their water portfolio. The tentative order permits the production and use of non-potable recycled water. However, it is important to note that potable reuse, another form of recycled water using advanced treatment, is also expanding in the San Diego region. This is in part between the collaboration between the San Diego Water Board and many different agencies pursuing and expanding recycled water projects throughout the region. Broader and more effective uses of recycled water are consistent with the goals and objectives of the recycled water policy and the San Diego Water Board's Practical Vision Strategy for Achieving a Sustainable Local Water Supply. The recycled water policy establishes criteria for recycled water project recycling requirements and waste discharge requirements. The intent of the recycled water policy is to protect designated beneficial uses and water quality while increasing recycled water use, allowing for streamlined permitting of appropriate landscape irrigation projects, and allowing basin-wide management of salts and nutrients. The order is consistent with the recycled water policy because the city is required to conduct annual volumetric reporting, implement nutrient management measures, and implement nutrient managing planning elements of the 2019 Integrated Regional Water Management Plan that addressed salt nutrient management plan requirements in Tier D and E basins in the San Diego region. The Otay and Tijuana hydrologic units are designated as low priority Tier D basins in the Table 7 of the 2019 Integrated Regional Water Management Plan because they have high concentrations of TDS in the groundwater. The San Diego Water Board adopted Order Number 2000-203 and the MNRP Number 2000-203 on November 8, 2000. The Order Number 2000-203 established WDRs and WRRs for the use sites within the Otay Valley and Tijuana Valley hydrologic areas. The MNRP 2000-203 established monitoring and reporting requirements for the facility, and Addendum Number 1, adopted in October 2004 by the San Diego Water Board, modified the discharge and disinfection specifications, facility operations manual, monitoring provisions, and effluent monitoring requirements based on recommendations from the Division of Drinking Water. Addendum Number 2, adopted in June of 2006 by the San Diego Water Board, further modified the design and operation specifications to incorporate additional DDW recommendations. Then, in 2020, the city installed a new UV system, which triggered the need for an update, for an update of the Title 22 engineering report and a subsequent update of the WDR order to reflect the new requirements put forth by DDW in their conditional approval letter. A little lag here. I apologize, my internet's moving slow. I'm not sure if you guys can see my next slide here. Construction of the new UV system began in January 2020, followed by the system testing and commissioning of the Title 22 report amendment in April 2020. The Trojan UV 4000 model system manufactured by Trojan Technologies was replaced with the Trojan UV Sigma model. This newer model employs low pressure lamps, reducing the operational and maintenance costs and requiring 80% less energy consumption per transmittance value during peak flow. Here are the significant changes when comparing Order Number 2000-203 and addenda with the tentative order. The tentative order establishes requirements for the use of recycled water fill station. It also allows the city to calculate and report the annual effluent concentrations for TDS, chloride, sulfate, manganese, MBAS, boron, and fluoride instead of the 30-day average effluent concentration. It changes the effluent discharge specifications for chloride from 260 milligrams per liter 30-day average to a 300 milligram per liter annual average, and for sulfate from 250 milligrams per liter 30-day average to a 300 milligram per liter annual average. The tentative order also changes the effluent limitation for both chloride and sulfate for the daily maximum discharge specifications from 300 milligrams to 350 milligrams per liter. It also allows the city to apply the basin plan's sodium hazard discharge specification alternative compliance to determine compliance with the percent sodium discharge specification. Additionally, it establishes a 15 milligram per liter total nitrogen discharge specification. It also requires volumetric reporting via GeoTracker as required by the recycled water policy. The tentative order adds general and specific discharge specifications and monitoring and reporting requirements for recycled water fill stations to accurately capture the extent of the city's recycled water purveyance and distribution system. Some of these requirements are training of the recycled water haulers and proper labeling of recycled water vessels. One of the uses for recycled water transported from the South Bay Water Reclamation fill stations is dust control at construction sites. The reissued WDRs also modifies the discharge specification for calculating and reporting the average effluent concentrations for TDS, chloride, sulfate, manganese, methylene blue activated substances, boron, and fluoride from a 30-day average to an annual average. This modification more accurately reflects the potential for the recycled water discharge to affect groundwater quality and is in line with the existing once-per-month sampling requirements for these constituents. The tentative order modifies the discharge specification for chloride to reflect realistic recycled water concentrations and support the implementation of the recycled water policy. The tentative order changes the discharge specification for chloride from 260 milligrams per liter to a 30-day average to a 300 milligram per liter annual average, and a 300 milligram per liter daily max to a 350 milligram per liter daily max. These updates to the discharge specifications are still significantly lower than the water quality objectives specified for the Otay Valley and Tijuana Valley hydrologic areas. As shown on this graph, the water quality objectives for chloride in the Otay Valley is 500 milligrams per liter, and in the Tijuana Valley hydrologic area, it is 550 milligrams per liter. Additionally, the Ralph P. Chapman Water Reclamation Facility, owned and operated by the Otay Water District, that also produces recycled water that is blended with the recycled water produced from the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant and potable water prior to use in the Otay Valley hydrologic area, has a maximum average chloride limit of 440 milligrams per liter. Therefore, the increase in the discharge specifications for chloride will not cause any exceedances of water quality objectives. The tentative order also modifies the sulfate discharge specification following the same logic as the chloride modification. It changes the 250 milligram per liter 30-day average to a 300 milligram per liter annual average and a 300 milligram per liter daily max to a 350 milligram per liter daily max. These updates to the discharge specifications are still significantly lower than the water quality objectives specified for the Otay Valley and Tijuana Valley hydrologic areas. The water quality objectives for sulfite in the Otay Valley is 500 milligrams per liter and 900 milligrams per liter in the Tijuana Valley. Therefore, the increase in discharge specifications for sulfate will not cause any exceedances of water quality objectives. Staff also modified the discharge specifications for evaluating compliance with the water quality objective for percent sodium to allow the city to apply the basin plan's sodium hazard discharge specification alternative compliance, which is consistent with other recycled water permits adopted by the San Diego Water Board. The basin plan establishes a groundwater quality objective for percent sodium that is protects agricultural supply and beneficial uses from potential hazards due to sodium in irrigation waters. The order keeps the discharge specification for sodium at the water quality objective of 60%. However, the basin plan provides an alternative compliance for the percent sodium water quality objective to determine the potential sodium hazard of irrigation water. The alternative compliance method determines the sodium hazard using a methodology that evaluates the adjusted sodium absorption ratio and electrical conductivity values in electrical conductivity of the water. The water quality objective is met if the adjusted SAR and electrical conductivity values indicate that the degree of restriction on use of the water is within or below the slight to moderate range as shown in Table 3.1 of the Basin Plan, or Table E1 here of the Tentative Order. Order number 2000-203 did not include discharge requirements for any form of nitrogen. The Tentative Order establishes a daily maximum total nitrogen effluent discharge specification of 15 milligrams per liter. A recent Basin Plan amendment raised the groundwater quality objective for nitrate to the drinking water standard of 45 milligrams per liter, or 10 milligrams per liter nitrate expressed as total nitrogen for all basins in the region except the Warner Basin, which is outside the purview of this project. It is important to note that if 10 milligrams per liter total nitrogen were to completely nitrify in the environment, it would equate to 45 milligrams per liter nitrate, and this is calculated using a stoichiometric equation. However, the city submitted a total nitrogen balance demonstrating that the concentration of 15 milligrams per liter total nitrogen will not exceed the groundwater quality objective for nitrate. This is due to the nutrient uptake by vegetation at the recycled water use areas, by adding up the total nitrogen applied through recycled water and fertilizer use and subtracting the nutrient uptake within the root zone, the city calculated that no excess nutrients should percolate into the underlying groundwater. In order to evaluate how the state is doing with meeting the recycled water goals set forth in the recycled water policy, the recent amendment, effective in 2019, required all wastewater treatment plants treating over 20,000 gallons per day to report their volumetric data. The treatment plants are required to supply influent volume, disposal volume, reuse volume, and a breakdown of reuse categories. Because of this new volumetric requirement, we know that in 2019, the South Bay Water Reclamation Plant treated approximately 3,370 acre feet of wastewater to tertiary standards, which was then disaffected and reused. That equates to 47% of the 7,216 acre feet of raw wastewater that the facility received in 2019. The San Diego Water Board released tentative order number R9-2021-0015 on March 30th, 2021 for a 30-day public review and comment period. The San Diego Water Board staff received one comment letter from the City of San Diego on April 28, 2021. The city identified two minor comments consisting of a typographical error and a request for clarification. In the first comment, the city suggested that the reduction in the discharge specification for boron from 0.75 in order 2000-203 to 0.5 in the tentative order is a typographical error and should be corrected. The San Diego Water Board staff agreed with the city's comment, prepared an errata sheet to the tentative order, correcting the discharge specification for boron from 0.5 to 0.75. In the second comment, the city requested clarification that the intent of the language and general monitoring provision, IK, of attachment D to the tentative order allows for time-weighted or flow-weighted composite sampling as long as the sample is representative. The general monitoring provision specifies that the composite samples must be flow proportional, either through modifying the time interval between the samples or the volume of each sample. The city can collect either a flow-weighted or a time-weighted sample, provided the composite sample is flow proportional. The San Diego Water Board received an additional email comment from the city regarding the tentative order after the close of the public comment period. The San Diego Water Board chair accepted the city's late comment letter into the record for this matter. The city requested a reduction in pH monitoring sampling from daily to 5 days a week to match the recently adopted NPDES order and not increase lab staffing costs. The San Diego Water Board staff agrees with the city's comment and made the corresponding change in their errata sheet to the tentative order to reflect the changes to the pH sampling requirements. These changes are consistent with the NPDES order issued to the city of San Diego at the board meeting in May. Staff's recommendation to the board members is to adopt the tentative order R9-2021-0015 as amended by the errata. At this time, I can answer any questions you may have. And we also have some staff from the City of San Diego's Public Utilities Department here present to answer any other additional questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Board members, do you have any questions of our staff or of representatives from the City of San Diego staff? Hearing none, let's open it for public comments. Roger, would you please call for public comments?
Absolutely. If there are any member of the public that wishes to speak to the board at this time, please virtually raise your hand in the Zoom application by pressing the button, Zoom raise your hand button, or press *9 on your phone now. Chair Cantu, I am not seeing any hands being raised.
Okay, last call for any questions from our board members. Executive Officer Gibson, do you have any closing statements?
Chair Cantu, very briefly. This is it seems like a very technical decision, but it actually provides some regulatory streamlining for the City of San Diego, I think, at a crucial time. It may be only a small measure, but being able to reduce some of the reporting requirements and ensure consistency with other facilities that are regulated for recycled water is appropriate and important at this time with drought. So for all the reasons indicated by staff, I recommend the adoption of the tentative order.
Thank you very much. We're happy to see recycling. We are far short of our goals as a state. So this is something we definitely need to continue. I'd like to commend the city on another issue that's not exactly, that's not, is this permit, and that's the pure water effort, which is the 21st century response to recycling. So that is good. At this point, we'll close the public hearing portion of this item and the board will deliberate. I'll call for a motion in a second.
I move approval.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you, Stephanie. Any further deliberation? The clerk, please call the roll.
Dr. Barbanel?
Aye.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
Ms. Blair?
Yes.
Dr. Olson?
Aye.
Mr. Strawn?
Aye.
Ms. Warren?
Aye.
Chair Cantu?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you very much. We have an informational item, the Aztec Path to Conquering PCE, something we're really anticipating and looking forward to. I would recommend, unless I hear any otherwise, that we continue to proceed and see how far we get before a noontime lunch break. Maybe we can get through it or maybe delay our lunch somewhat. So let's start. This is an informational item to inform the board and the public of the successful efforts to identify historic dry cleaner facilities in San Diego County through the partnership developed between the board's staff and San Diego State SAGE project. We will not be taking any action today.
Thank you, Chair Cantu. I'd just like to point out, as Tom Aulo queues up to give the presentation to begin it, that this is an opportunity for us to fulfill a longstanding request of the board that we form relationships with academia and be able to bring students and faculty to work with us on critical questions. This was a SAGE project that Henry and Sarah Marin and myself visited San Diego State about a few years ago, and I'm really glad that we had this opportunity to bring this project to its conclusion. We are going to pursue future opportunities with SAGE and San Diego State, and particularly with agriculture, but this was an important one. We wanted to start with our environmental justice program in looking at how we have closed sites in the past and whether or not we need to reevaluate them for certain underserved communities. So with that, I turn it over to you, Tom Aulo, and thank you very much.
Can everybody see my screen?
We can. Proceed, please.
Hello, Board Chair Cantu and members of the board. My name is Tom Aulo, and I'm a water resource control engineer in the site restoration unit at the San Diego Water Board. My supervisor, Sarah Marin, and I are managing a contract between the Water Board and San Diego State University's SAGE project. We partnered with SAGE to find historical dry cleaners in San Diego County because of their potential to affect groundwater quality and impact human health. Today, I'll be giving you some general information regarding the site restoration unit, the effects of chemical spills and leaks from historical dry cleaners. I'll explain what vapor intrusion is, present an overview of underserved communities, and the people most likely to be affected by vapor intrusion, also known as sensitive receptors. And I'll go over the partnership between the San Diego Water Board and SDSU's SAGE project. The site restoration unit is part of the statewide site cleanup program. We provide regulatory oversight for investigation and cleanup of polluted sites where recent or historical releases of pollutants to the environment have occurred. Affected media include soil, groundwater, surface water, sediment, and air. The sites we regulate are varied and include dry cleaners, aerospace manufacturing facilities, and shipyards, to name a few. We are responsible for managing site cleanup program cases within Region 9. Case management involves communicating with dischargers, consultants, the public, and other agencies, as well as coordinating casework to ensure pollutant releases are identified, investigated, and cleaned up. We work with dischargers either voluntarily or through an informal enforcement path. We prepare investigative orders and cleanup and abatement orders as needed to compel dischargers to perform investigative and or remedial work. Tetrachloroethylene, or PCE, is a solvent used to clean and remove stains from clothes. Many historical dry cleaners have intentionally dumped or accidentally spilled PCE into the environment where it contaminates soil and groundwater. The Site Restoration Unit oversees many dry cleaner sites in the San Diego region that are contaminated with PCE. PCE breaks down slowly and easily moves from liquid form into gas form. Because of this, dry cleaners with PCE releases not only leads to groundwater pollution, but also results in PCE exposure to people when they breathe in air containing PCE that has moved into the building through the vapor intrusion pathway. So what is the vapor intrusion pathway? Vapor intrusion is the migration of chemicals present in vapor or air into a building, such as a nearby home or business. Vapor intrusion is caused by a release of one or more chemicals into the soil and or groundwater, such as, for example, PCE released from a historical dry cleaner. If uncontrolled, PCE chemical vapors can move through gaps and cracks in a building foundation or into a sewer line and eventually in the building. In this way, the PCE can be present in the air breathed by people within the building. PCE can also, under certain conditions, break down to trichloroethene, or TCE. TCE is a chemical that, when present in air inside a building, requires an immediate action, such as increasing outdoor air circulation, to avoid or reduce health risks to building occupants from breathing in TCE. The EPA classifies PCE and TCE as chemicals that can cause serious health issues, including cancer. This is why the Site Restoration Unit has a lot of interest in historical dry cleaners in the San Diego region. Releases from historical dry cleaners can occur within underserved communities where environmental justice is a concern. Underserved communities are areas that have higher poverty, unemployment, air and water pollution, hazardous waste, and serious health effects. Dry cleaner releases can also occur near buildings occupied by people that have high risks of experiencing serious health issues due to chemical exposure. For example, schools, daycares, and elderly care facilities. Dry cleaner releases near homes are also important to identify because people spend longer periods of time in their homes as opposed to places where they work. The San Diego Water Board teamed up with SDSU SAGE Project to identify the locations of these historical dry cleaners with a goal of protecting groundwater resources and human health, with a particular focus on underserved communities. We work closely with students to identify and map dry cleaners using a variety of data sources to create geographic information system, or GIS layers, that will be integrated into the Water Board's mapping tool called DIVOTS, which is short for Data and Information Visualization Tools. In general, DIVOTS display data and information to a user in a more accessible format. As you may recall, back in 2019, Wayne Chu of your staff presented DIVOTS to you using the San Diego-based sediment chemistry data. The work completed by SDSU students will allow the San Diego Water Board to identify and prioritize high-risk dry cleaner sites within underserved communities and nearby sensitive receptors, issue investigative orders to discharges directing them to conduct soil gas, and groundwater investigations, and issue cleanup and abatement orders to discharges directing them to clean up waste in a manner that protects groundwater resources and human health. Because of the success of this project, we will be able to identify and clean up previously unknown releases of waste that disproportionately affect vulnerable communities. Unless you have any questions for me, I'll turn it over to Dr. Jessica Barlow from SAGE and SDSU's class project manager, Cheyenne Graves and Jessica Embry. Also in attendance to answer questions are Christopher Patron Soberano from SAGE Project, SDSU professors Kristen Monteverde, Christy Dykstra and Madison Swain, and student assistant Jolene Pizarro.
Thank you.
Okay, well, my name is Jessica Barlow. Thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you to members of the board. I'm the executive director of San Diego State University's Center for Regional Sustainability. And together with Christopher Patron Soberano, we help run the SAGE project, which is part of that center. The SAGE project partners with local municipalities to tackle high priority projects in the community that address environmental, economic, and social justice needs and aim to improve quality of life in the region. We do this by engaging faculty members and their students through existing classes on campus. So these are classes that are already on the books, already part of a faculty member's teaching load, and we connect those classes with these real-world place-based projects. And what's critical to these partnerships is that each project be connected with more than one discipline so that it truly be a multidisciplinary approach to addressing community needs. We've worked with 7 different municipalities and 4 other community organizations to address about 70 different projects in the region since 2013, and over 4,000 students from across campus who are able to engage in community and place-based real-world projects, which help to better prepare them for the workforce by enhancing their critical thinking and problem-solving skills, all while addressing a real need in the community. And so for this past academic year, we worked on the identification of high-risk dry cleaning sites in San Diego County, which involved different disciplines that worked in collaboration. We had students from environmental engineering, geography, public affairs, plus extensive and critical engagement with the university library faculty and staff on this project in order to digitize a very large amount of hard copy files from the Water Board office. The work done by the library and the environmental engineering students to cull the data on dry cleaning sites was then fed to the geography and public affairs students to map and validate the data. In total, we had 4 classes, 4 disciplines, 6 faculty members, 75 students from across these disciplines, 7 student internships connected to this effort. And through all these efforts, we estimate that we have collectively dedicated about 5,000 hours of effort toward this project. And together in this partnership, we've identified over 500 dry cleaning sites. And with that, I'm pleased to turn it over to Cheyenne Graves and Jessica Embry, who will present the results of the work completed over this past academic year.
Thank you. That sounds very exciting.
Hi, my name is Cheyenne Graves. I'm a master's student in the Civil Engineering Department at San Diego State University. And I was a student project manager for the Environmental 558 Solid and Hazardous Waste Engineering class. So to identify dry cleaning sites in San Diego County, 2 or more student groups were assigned to the 6 regions of the county to provide overlap and reduce the likelihood of overlooking sites. The class consisted of 60 students, and there were 15 teams in total. The 6 areas of study were Central, East, North Central, North Coastal, North Inland, and the South Region. Next slide, please. The analysis procedure for the students involved conducting background research on the assigned regions to locate dry cleaning businesses, collecting location information from businesses, and identifying responsible parties and determining whether the site was at risk. Next slide, please. Source materials used for the data collection included using search engines to gather data on present and historical dry cleaning businesses, searching through historical documents, such as the San Diego Digital Archives, to find older dry cleaning businesses that may not be accounted for online. Search engines and websites to identify sites included the Better Business Bureau, Google Search Engine, and Yelp. Additionally, the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board's records were searched for dry cleaning site information. In order to view these files, the San Diego State University's library staff scanned selected files with potential site information, and these scanned files were then made available for students to search for site locations. After the existence of a dry cleaning business was established, we then determined the location of the dry cleaning site For most businesses, the address was available. However, in rare instances, only latitude and longitude data were available. This may occur, for instance, when the street or building of a historical dry cleaning site no longer exists. When only a street address was available, we determined the latitude and longitude using Google Maps, Google Earth, and ArcGIS. The responsible parties and owners were then identified using, again, Better Business Bureau, Yelp, Google search engine, additionally tax information and APN numbers, historical archives, and occasionally a business was called and information was either willingly given or not. However, not all responsible parties were identifiable through the available resources. Additionally, data was documented for the record date and whether the location is currently active or whether the responsible party was the current or last known owner and any notes pertaining to the facility. Next slide, please. Upon submission of the collected data, the information was reviewed for initial findings and validated. The method used for review comprised of a second search of the business and validation of the site address and location. The second search of each business was conducted using Google search engine and was used to confirm the existence of a site and an address which matched the initial finding. At that stage, owners and responsible parties were also confirmed, and if new information was found for a business, the new information was included in the final database. For additional validation, site addresses and latitude and longitude coordinates were located using Google Earth to confirm each site's existence and location. Site locations that could not be confirmed via search engine or Google Earth were determined to be historical sites. These sites were retained in the database, but were noted as unvalidated. So after this preliminary validation process, 594 dry cleaning sites were identified. Next slide, please. So for our project deliverables, we produced a database of dry cleaning sites, which was sent to the GIS classes, and a final technical report that elaborates on our sourcing methods and materials of site locations and final findings and discussion. Additionally, our report contains a remediation methods and recommendations part, which, if the board members are interested, Dr. Dykstra has prepared a presentation that can be shared describing remediation recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a great partnership. Would you like to hear the presentation on remediation? Are we ready to begin? Okay, let's go forward. Remediation.
The remediation can be given by Dr. Dykstra at the end of this presentation.
Oh, okay. So do we have a presentation prior to that?
Yes. Okay. Hi, my name is Jessica Embry. I'm a geography student at SDSU. As the student project manager for the geography department, I worked on this project spatial analysis and prepared the delivered database containing all dry cleaning site information. This portion of the project brought together students and instructors from three different courses, Geography 584, Geography 499, and Public Administration 540. Next slide, please. Today, I'll share information about dry cleaning site placement decisions and remote validation, spatial analysis techniques, and project results. But first, I will introduce the project deliverables. Next slide, please. After the initial data collection was completed, we converted the tabular dry cleaning site information into a spatial database. This database consists of different geographic information systems, or GIS, layers with spatial information that can be displayed on a map, as well as non-spatial attribute data. The main layer has a record for each dry cleaning site. The records contain spatial point features reflecting the dry cleaner locations and all associated data, such as responsible parties. These records can be queried to find dry cleaners in underserved or disadvantaged communities, or those with nearby sensitive receptor sites, or even all dry cleaners in a specific region of the county. This functionality lets the user decide what is most important and pinpoints dry cleaning sites of interest for further investigation. Next slide, please. Now that I've described the project's final product, that spatial database, I'll discuss dry cleaner site placement. Next, please. Address and coordinate information was recorded during the initial data collection process for nearly all dry cleaning sites. In order to ensure that we use the most accurate coordinates for the spatial analysis, we generated additional candidate coordinates for each site using different geocoding services. Then we used a remote validation procedure to look at each set of candidate coordinates and identify which were the most accurate. Next slide, please. In the previous slide, I mentioned the use of geocoding services. Geocoding is simply the process of converting a street address into geographic coordinates, a latitude and a longitude. Four different services were used: Google, ArcGIS, Bing, and Nominatim. The returned coordinates from each service and the geographic coordinates recorded during data collection were combined to create sets of candidate locations. The number of candidates for each dry cleaner varied depending upon the collected data and the success of the geocoding services. Next slide, please. But which of the candidates in each set is the most accurate? A remote validation procedure was developed to define a consistent method for analyzing candidates and selecting the final coordinates to be used in the analysis. Here is the set of candidate points for LC Embroidery and Cleaners on Main Street in San Diego. Looking at the satellite imagery, we can see that this is a commercial area along Main Street. Since some points are within the building, the orange point along the road can be eliminated. The next step is to select the point closest to the center of the dry cleaning building, or suite. In this case, that is the green point with coordinates from the Google geocoder. If multiple points were located at the centroid, then the final selection would be based upon the source of those coordinates. Provided coordinates from the environmental engineering course would be prioritized, followed by coordinates from the Google geocoder, and so on. Next slide, please. Once the best possible coordinates were selected for each dry cleaning site, the spatial analysis could be conducted. Next, please. The spatial analysis itself had two main components. The first part was to identify all dry cleaning sites located within disadvantaged communities, a designation that is defined by Senate Bill 535 legislation. Per Senate Bill 535, a disadvantaged community is in the top 25% scoring areas from CalEnvirus Green, along with other areas with high amounts of pollution and low populations. The CalEnvirus Green tool was created by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment and gives information about which communities are most affected by different sources of pollution. So for the purpose of this project, I will refer to disadvantaged communities, and these are census tracts with high exposure or high vulnerability to pollution. The second part of the analysis was to identify dry cleaning sites that were near sensitive receptor sites. According to the California Air Resources Board Air Quality and Land Use Handbook, sensitive receptor sites have land uses where sensitive individuals are most likely to spend time, including schools and schoolyards, parks and playgrounds, daycare centers, nursing homes, hospitals, and residential communities. We also included municipal wells, since pollution near these sites could affect community drinking water. Next, please. The first portion of the analysis was fairly straightforward. On this slide, disadvantaged communities are colored in red. A spatial overlay operation identified which dry cleaning sites were within the boundaries of a disadvantaged or underserved community. This is illustrated by the image on the lower left. You can see that Langley Cleaners is within the red disadvantaged community, while Mason's Cleaners and El Dorado Cleaners are not. The map on the right shows the full extent of disadvantaged communities in San Diego County. I'd like to point out that most Senate Bill 535 disadvantaged communities are located in the central and southern portions of the county, and none are present in North County. Next slide, please. The second part of the analysis was more complicated. Eight sensitive receptor site categories were selected: schools, colleges, childcare facilities, hospitals, long-term health care and hospice facilities, active parks, residential sites, and municipal wells. The map pictured here shows some of the county's many sensitive sites. Residential sites were the most common type of sensitive receptor site by far. Additionally, complexities in the source data necessitated a different analytical approach for residential sites. For the non-residential categories, we provide a specific number of sensitive sites near each dry cleaner, such as two schools. However, different types of residential ownership and different community sizes make the direct comparison of residential sites using available GIS data impossible. Therefore, a counted number of residential sites would be misleading. So instead of counting how many individual residential sites were near each dry cleaner, we recorded whether residential sites were present or absent in the area. Another factor to consider when finding sensitive receptor sites near a dry cleaner, how near is near? Based on siting guidelines in the Air Quality and Land Use Handbook, three distance zones were determined: 300 feet, 500 feet, and 1,000 feet. A distance table was generated that listed all sensitive receptor sites within 1,000 feet of a dry cleaner. This data was aggregated to provide specific information about the different sensitive receptor site categories, as well as the different distance zones. Next slide, please. Now I'll share some of the project results. Next. This map shows all dry cleaning sites identified during this project. The dark red points are those that are in disadvantaged or underserved communities, and the gray points are in what we call non-disadvantaged communities. I wanted to show the general distribution of dry cleaners within the county before moving on. Next slide, please. 522 dry cleaners are included in the project. This number is different from the one shared earlier by Cheyenne because some sites were either combined or eliminated during our remote validation process. 37 dry cleaning sites are located in disadvantaged communities, with 17 in the south region, 13 in the central region, and 7 in the east region. The chart on the right shows the total number of dry cleaners in each region and the proportion of those dry cleaners that are in disadvantaged communities. The north central and north coastal regions have the most dry cleaning sites overall, followed by the east, south, central, and north inland regions. Next slide, please. On to the sensitive receptor sites. Let's look at the largest distance zone first, 1,000 feet. More than 95% of the dry cleaners have residential sites within 1,000 feet. Remember that residential sites were analyzed separately from the other sensitive receptor site categories. About 2/3 of the dry cleaners have one or more non-residential sensitive receptor site within 1,000 feet. These dry cleaners pose a risk to 575 individual sensitive sites. The pie chart shown here breaks down the number of sensitive receptor sites by category. Childcare facilities are the most numerous type of at-risk sensitive receptor site, followed by schools and then parks. There are only 2 municipal wells within 1,000 feet of any dry cleaner. I'll return to that in a moment. Next slide, please. Here is a similar chart showing the number of non-residential at-risk sensitive receptor sites separated by county region. There are more sites located in the north central and north coastal regions, but these regions also have the highest number of dry cleaners. In general, the regional trends are the same as countywide trends, but in the south region, there is a greater relative risk to schools and parks. Also, the 2 municipal wells are both found in the south region. Next slide, please. The 2 wells are each about 950 feet away from a dry cleaner. One is located near Continental Cleaners and Laundry in National City, and the other is located near Superwash and Dry in Chula Vista. These maps show red points for the dry cleaning sites and blue points for the municipal wells. The yellow ring indicates the 1,000 foot distance zone. Next slide, please. Moving on to the 500 foot distance zone, 88.7% of dry cleaners have residential sites within 500 feet. Meanwhile, only 1/3 of dry cleaners have non-residential sensitive sites within 500 feet. At this distance zone, 214 individual non-residential sensitive sites are at risk. Although the municipal wells category is now absent from the pie chart, the separation by category should look familiar with, you know, the largest pie slice for childcare facilities and then schools, parks, and so on. Next slide, please. Here are the at-risk sensitive sites within the 500-foot distance zone separated by region. The relative risk to schools has increased at this distance and is now greater than the risk to childcare facilities in the central, east, and south regions. Next slide, please. Finally, we'll look at the 300-foot distance zone. About 3/4 of the dry cleaners have residential sites within 300 feet. Nearly 16% of dry cleaning sites have non-residential sensitive sites within 300 feet, putting 100 individual non-sensitive sites, non-residential sensitive sites at risk. The pie chart for this distance zone looks very similar to the one we saw for the 500-foot distance zone. Next slide, please. When looking at the at-risk sensitive sites by region, you might notice that the relative risk to schools has increased even further in the central and south regions, while decreasing again in the east region. Otherwise, we see a generally familiar pattern with the highest risk to childcare facilities, then schools and parks, then colleges, hospitals, and healthcare facilities. In fact, only 14 of the 100 sensitive sites fall into those final three categories: colleges, hospitals, and healthcare facilities. Next, please. Before wrapping up, I'd like to return quickly to the project deliverables. Next. This is a slide I showed you at the beginning of the presentation. The results I shared with you today were based upon attribute data found in the main dry cleaning sites layer. I showed you dry cleaners near municipal wells. This is one example of how the database might be queried to find high-risk dry cleaning sites. All supporting data, such as the features for the actual wells, is also included in the database. Next, please. Here is another example where I queried the database to find a high-risk dry cleaning site. I considered three criteria: location in a disadvantaged community, presence of residential sites, and number of all non-residential sensitive sites within 300 feet. With these criteria, I identified Langley Cleaners, a historic dry cleaner in National City. If pollution was found at this site, then one elementary school, two preschools, and multiple residences might be at risk. Next, please. In addition to the spatial database, we provide several metadata documents to help users navigate the database and the different GIS layers. Also, in the technical report, there is an appendix that provides tabular summaries of the results similar to those shared during this presentation. It is expected that the technical report will be submitted within the next week. Next, please. Thank you very much for your attention during this presentation. I think at this time, the team could either answer questions or we can move on to Dr. Dykstra's presentation.
We'll open it up for questions of the board at this point. Well, before we move forward, I just want to say this is fantastic information. We see lots of information in charts. We don't see the geospatial distribution, and that, you know, means all the difference in the world. I really appreciate you focusing on at-risk communities and underserved communities, because it really helps us to look about where we prioritize our own research. Most of these were all cited. Most of these dry cleaners were cited prior to our understanding of the impacts and the prevalence of PCP. So this is very valuable to us. Thank you very much. You all have done a fantastic job. This partnership to us is invaluable as we move forward. Let's continue. Dr. Dykstra? We can see you. There you are. We can hear you now.
Hello. All right. Tom, do you have my slides?
I do. I'm having a little bit of trouble pulling it up. So if you could give me a second.
Sure.
As we wait for the slides to go on, is it my understanding that our staff has access to all of this data and can manipulate it and spend a lot of time on it and have it inform us? That's fantastic. Very much appreciate that.
Hi, Sarah Muron, senior engineering geologist. I worked with Tom on this project. Yeah, we're waiting for the report to come in, and we are working to get the layers for the GIS.
I'd just like to ask one question. So since schools and daycare centers were quite prevalent, and then the same areas had residential. Is there any way you can determine if children are, so if I'm going to school and I live in the area, I get an even larger potential exposure. Is there any way to point that out, to see that, or is that too granular?
I think the next thing that we're going to have to do is come up with a priority list and determine which areas and which sites we should focus on first. And that's where we're going to have to rank those multiple layers of risk.
Okay, thank you.
It's often the synergistic effects that we overlook. So thank you very much, Dr. Olson, for raising that. Dr. Dystra, maybe you can start verbally as we are looking for your slides.
Sure. Let's see. And actually, let me see if I'm able to share my screen. I can bring them up.
Yes, I apologize. I'm having trouble on my end.
All right. Are you able to see my slides
here? We are. Thank
you. Okay,
excellent.
All right. So just a quick run through of how PCE or TCE does get into the environment. And the reason, first of all, that we talk about both PCE and TCE is because PCE can easily be converted to TCE in the environment, especially in low oxygen sediments and groundwater. And some of the ways that these get into the environment is through obviously dumping. And this is why we wanted to look at historical sites because prior to regulations of PCE and TCE, a lot of sites would do dumping as a way to get rid of spent chemicals. Also, there can be spills, drips, leaking of storage tanks and pipes, and of course, there can be illegal dumping as well. So with that in mind, let's see if I can get to the second slide here. Okay, there we go, it's a little slow. So what happens when PCE and TCE is released? So if you have a leak, for example, the PCE and TCE is a relatively dense and heavy chemical, does not mix with water very well. And so what we see happening is that it tends to move downwards in the subsurface. And if we have an impermeable geological formation, it can pool on top of that formation and become part of the groundwater flow. So we sort of need to kind of look at different remediation methods, whether or not the leak is primarily in the unsaturated soil sediments or whether it has migrated into the groundwater. So there's kind of two different categories of remediation. My slides are lagging a bit here, so I apologize. But we have in situ, having an issue here. Okay, can you see my slide that says how can we remediate contaminated sites?
We can.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
You may want to put it in presentation mode.
Oh, it is not. Okay, there we go. Let's see. Did that do the trick? I hope so.
No, but you know, we could see it just fine. So please proceed.
Okay. So we can remediate these sites either through in situ, which is in place remediation without disturbing the site or removing the contaminated materials, or we can do ex situ remediation methods that require the removal of the contaminated material or contaminated water to be treated. And so there's benefits and drawbacks to each. So for in situ methods, we get less control over remediation conditions because we're remediating in the environment So this may cause our process to go a little bit slower. However, this is less invasive or disruptive to the site. Now, ex situ methods do give us more control over reaction conditions. So we often can achieve faster transformation and removal of these contaminants. However, there are some considerations for space for treatment systems. It can be disruptive, especially if excavation of soil is required. And in some cases, it may not fully capture PCE and TCE due to the high density and hydrophobicity of these chemicals. So I wanted to highlight a few of the possible and effective treatment methods. First of all, looking at the soil remediation, and this would be in cases where the PCE or TCE contamination has not yet reached the groundwater. So in the unsaturated portion of the soil, we can do what's called soil vapor extraction. And in this case, we would place a well into a contaminated area of the soil, attach a vacuum blower that would draw air in from around the soil into the contaminated zone. And because these are very, these chemicals can easily move to the vapor phase, these vapors can then be collected through the vacuum, go to a treatment, and then treat that gas, and then off-gas it after treatment. Another method, obviously, is soil excavation. Of course, this is relatively disruptive of the site, but it is effective, and the soil can be trucked off to off-site remediation and, you know, controlled conditions. Now, if the leak or the TCU PCE has reached the groundwater, one of the methods that we can do is pump and treat. So this is an ex situ method where we pump, we place a pump into the groundwater flow. We pump that water out and we do water treatment to remove the PCE and TCE, and then use that treated water either reinject or to treat it off-site or remediate that in some way. So this would be an ex-situ method. An in-situ method for groundwater remediation would be a permeable reactive barrier. And one of the best mechanisms for this is to use zero valent iron. This is essentially just really finely ground iron, metallic iron, that's placed into a trench that will allow the groundwater, the contaminated groundwater, to flow through that barrier. And as it flows through that barrier, that zero valent iron helps to reduce the PCE and TCE and convert them to other less chlorinated compounds. And finally, another method of in situ remediation is with bioremediation. And so in this case, we would be pumping nutrients or organic materials such as glucose, methanol, lactate, et cetera, into the groundwater. This stimulates fermentative microorganisms to release hydrogen that can be used by a second group of microorganisms to remove the chlorine or dechlorinate these PCE and TCE chemicals, ultimately resulting in less chlorinated compounds. And the goal here is to get all the way to ethene and basically completely remediate and remove all the chlorine molecules from these compounds in order to make them less toxic. So here's a quick summary of the remediation methods that we examined. They're classified by type and their effectiveness as per the literature, and then also level of site disturbance, which indicates which might be more or less optimal for different locations that are identified for through this project. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Dystra. Questions? Well, I'll just say thank you very much. Dry cleaner remediation and PCEs has been something that we've been working on for decades. We're not finished with the long list yet. I really appreciate this tool that our staff can use to prioritize. So while the list is still long, we are able to prioritize and go to those places where people are the longest, either where they're sleeping during the day or they're in school or daycare for more than 8 hours a day, as opposed to just coming and going. So that's incredibly valuable to us. This partnership is very much appreciated and has proven to be so helpful to us, and probably to the state of California, even larger. So thank you very much. I hope you are able to present your report in such a way that you can publicize it, get a publication out of it. Clearly, it's something that's a resume builder for your students as they move forward, and we'd like to see them at the water board offices. They come pre-trained, and we really appreciate that. This is something that's going to serve us for a very long time. I'll turn it over to Dave if you have anything that you would like to say on this.
Yeah, thank you, Celeste. This is a really great presentation. Really do appreciate all of the efforts of your faculty and staff and students. Outstanding work, really. I would like to ask if it would be okay for me to share the presentations with our State Board liaison, Laurel Firestone, and with the State Board Executive Director, Eileen Sobeck. This is a unique opportunity, but not the only one, and would like to encourage the State Board to further support our efforts to work with San Diego State and with SAGE. We were able to find the funding for it that 1 year. We'll have to wait for another year, but I would like to ask for that funding to be amplified even this year, if it's practicable. There must be some money in Sacramento to further such a great cause and such great effort and work. And I do thank you and compliment you for your outstanding contribution today.
Thank you. So we'll move on to our next agenda item, which is board members' requests. Do our board members have any requests for future agenda items, recommended course of action, or stuff they would like our staff to look into? Keeping in mind that our staff are oversubscribed and under-resourced and do the very best that they can, which is something we're quite appreciative of.
No, I just would repeat, Kelly, my request for sort of a holistic overview of some of the issues that were raised today in regards to the ACL settlement with the city of Laguna Beach. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you. That would be good work. Anybody else? Okay, well, we have completed our agenda items. Thank you very much. And thank you for all the participants, and particularly the SAGE project and Dr. Barlow's group. We will wait and see you a month from now. Thank you very much. And we'll adjourn.
Thank you so much.